Radio. They're a late night favorite at the Green Lady, and they'll be performing an hour of all original tunes. Join us for Live at Green Lady Lounge with the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. That's this evening at 6 o'clock on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find food for meetings and company events, with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at EasyCater.com. And Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeInCookware.com. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Emmy Blotnick, Luke Burbank, and Brian Babylon. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Right now, it is time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on the air, or check out the pinned post on our Instagram page at Wait, Wait, NPR. Hi, you are on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. This is Yvonne in Olympia, Washington.
I love Olympia, nice. Washington. One of my favorite places. I have good friends there. What do you do?
I am an artist and a middle school art teacher, and I also play in a band called Sticks and Bones.
Sticks and Bones. Nice. What kind of band is it?
It's a queer women-led honk band, all inclusive, all abilities, yeah.
Honk music? Is that like where you just show up and just honk on your instruments?
Well, that's what I do because I don't know how to play, but...
Yvonne, well, welcome to the show. You're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Bill, what is Yvonne's topic?
Traveling for business?
The work trip. They're so great. It's a chance to meet colleagues from all over, to see new places, and finally, enjoy anything you want from the minibar because you're not paying. This week we heard about chaos on a work trip. Our panel is going to tell you about it. Pick the one who's telling the truth. You'll win the Wait Waiter of your choice on your voicemail. You ready to play?
Yes.
All right. First up, it is Luke Burbank.
Robert Baluku, a Ugandan delegate to the United Nations, recently found himself between a rock and a hard place. As The Guardian reported this week, a UN conference in Cali, Colombia, had so many delegates in attendance that the city completely ran out of hotel rooms. So Baluku and others ended up staying at Motel Desires, an hourly rental sex motel with rooms featuring stripper poles, sex swings, circular beds, and mirrors on the ceilings. The setup is quite different from other hotel rooms, said Baluku, who has now been declared Uganda's Minister of Understatement. But motel manager Diana Echeverry made it her goal to welcome the delegates, even cooking them a fresh breakfast each morning of eggs, coffee, and traditional Colombian bread. And it seemed to work. According to the article, the delegates kind of loved Motel Desires. We are enjoying ourselves, Baluku told The Guardian. This motel is more comfortable than many of the other places we've stayed. Now, if you can excuse me, I need to stare at my reflection in the ceiling and practice my presentation for tomorrow.
Delegates to a very serious UN conference in Cali, Colombia, having to stay in a sex motel. Your next out-of-office message comes from Emmy Blotnick.
When Samantha Myers started her internship at a Canadian construction company, she thought it would be straightforward. She never thought she'd be sent on a clandestine business trip to broker a deal with the Quebecois Mafia. According to the Globe and Mail, Samantha took some liberties under the special skills section of her resume. I saw it as an aspirational space, Samantha explained. Her special skills were mentalist, hostage negotiation, and perfect French. Unfortunately, her skills were just the thing her employer needed to broker a major deal with a rival. They needed 100 tons of gravel at a low price, so they sent Samantha to the province to meet with the head of the construction mafia. Samantha took her can-do attitude and 2 weeks of Duolingo French to the meeting and came home with an incredible deal, 100 tons of well-made Quebecois gravy. The French word for gravel is gravier, so I got confused. But really, anyone could have made this mistake, explained Samantha, the only person who could have made this mistake. The gravy will be mixed into concrete, and so now all Ontario roads will smell like slow-cooked beef. It's a win-win.
A woman sent to negotiate with the Quebecois mafia to get gravel and came back with gravy instead. Your last story of getting all up in somebody's business travel comes from Brian Babylon.
Archaeologists from all over the world gathered in Chicago this week for the Global Archaeology Conference were amazed by a discovery that would change everything they thought they knew about the ancient world. One exhibit booth showcased newly unearthed relics from an excavation somewhere in the Egyptian desert. Items include an ancient tablet adorned with hieroglyphics spelling out LOL and ROFL, a ceremonial cup with an embedded QR code, and a clay tablet engraved with what looked like an iPhone. Professors from top universities were soon gathered around, nodding seriously, with Dr. Viva Cohen, a specialist in Egypt's Third Dynasty, proclaiming, "Perhaps what we have been calling hieroglyphics the whole time were secretly emojis." She spent 30 minutes analyzing the tablet until a student scanned the QR code, revealing a YouTube video of cats dressed as pharaohs. Gasp turned to laughter as a group of PhD students revealed it was a prank. Most professors took it with stride, with Dr. Cohen laughing, "It's a reminder that we need to think outside the tomb, ha ha ha. Now, if you will, I need to go look at that cat video again."
So something happened recently when some people left their offices at home to work abroad. Was it, from Luke Burbank, some diplomats at a serious UN conference in Cali, Colombia, having to stay at a hotel for a more hourly clientele? From Emmy Blotnick, a woman who was sent by her boss to get some gravel came back with gravy instead because of her poor French? Or from Brian Babylon, archaeologists gathering in Chicago were fooled by what seemed to be a discovery of ancient high technology. Which of these is the real story of a work trip?
So I'm going to go with Luke's hotel sex desires.
All right, well, to bring you the correct answer, we spoke to a reporter who reported on that story.
They took out some of the sex swings and chairs, so they tried to, like, slightly de-sex it.
That was Phoebe Weston, a biodiversity reporter for The Guardian, who visited the sex hotel along with the diplomats. Congratulations, Yvonne, you got it right. Luke was, in fact, telling the truth. I see. Sometimes that.
For once.
And you have won our prize, the voice of anyone you might choose. Congratulations, Yvonne.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Keep honking.
I will.
Take care. And now the game we call Not My Job. Actor Brian Jordan Alvarez didn't wait for some network to let him do a sitcom. He spent years making TV series and movies with his friends, putting them on YouTube between his acting jobs. Finally, FX on Hulu got the hint in his new show, English Teacher, which he created and stars in, is their latest hit. Brian Jordan Alvarez, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you for having me.
So welcome. You have had this remarkable career, but right now it has brought you to this new sitcom on Hulu, which everybody loves. It's called English
Yes.
Teacher. And for people who don't know it, it is about, in fact, an English teacher. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And I do. I've cast myself in the role of the titular English teacher.
Right. How'd you get the part? Did you, like, a killer audition?
I talked to the guy who created the show, and he was like, "You have a good look, and we want you for this." Yeah, which was me.
The character is openly gay, and sometimes has to deal with all these expectations that people have of him.
Yeah, and I accept that about him, by the way.
You're very. Yeah, it's very open-minded for you
yeah,
to play.
Yeah, I was like, it's okay. Yeah.
You're right. That's cool.
my own sort of way of thinking.
Yeah. Have you been, like, contacted by some of the teachers you had when you were growing up saying, "It's me, isn't it? That part where he's really sensitive, that's me, right?"
not saying it's me, isn't it? But I have had a lot of sort of Facebook support from one of my teachers, Phil White, who is he would perch on his chair. He would always be squatting on his chair, and he would spill coffee all over himself. And so, yeah, I had a lot of great English teachers, though. Claire Reichman and Tom Gladstone, and I just like to name drop my English teachers.
Right,
you know?
Right.
We get it.
So when you're crouching in a chair spilling coffee all over yourself, you say, this is because of the great teachers I had.
Yeah, exactly.
The show is set, obviously, in the present day. Did you have to, like, research, like, how high school has changed since you were there? Did you bring in...
I had to research the present day because I live in the past. I'm,
right.
like, so stuck in the past.
Yeah.
You know? No, you know, what it is that I'm very online, as they say. I'm sort of terminally online. Part of me that I'm always trying to improve is the part of me that can't get through most... film and TV because I'm on TikTok too much. So then I think that's to the show's benefit. I sort
yes.
of know, you know, how people are talking right now and what people are arguing about online. And so some of that translates.
So you made a name for yourself by posting all of these videos to YouTube and TikTok. You've got self-made movies. You've got TV shows. You've got a video, just one I picked at random, called Dancing to Cheeseburger in Paradise, which is literally just you dancing shirtless to the Jimmy Buffett song Cheeseburger in Paradise.
Yes. And yeah, that was a lot of these are sort of COVID outgrowths where uh-huh. it's like you're in your apartment so long, and as a creative person, you just start coming up with nonsense, basically.
Really? And you say, what am I going to do today? I don't know. I'll dance around to Cheeseburger in Paradise and put it on the internet, and then I'll go have lunch. Is that like your thought process?
Yeah, it's just like, how do I keep releasing content even when my only idea is to dance in my underwear? Then I'll just post that.
You're having a big moment with that again, Brian, because you've been doing this meme, like this film, What Can You Offer My Daughter? And the guy says nothing
yes.
and then does this dance. You've done roughly 1,000 of those in the last week.
Yes, 1,000. Yes.
Yeah.
How did you land on that?
So that's a TikTok trend. I saw somebody do it. I thought it was really funny. I don't think that I'm aware I've ever been part of a sort of a traditional TikTok dancing trend until now. And so English teacher, I'm very proud of, you know, the critics loved it and a lot of people were watching it, but I wanted more people to watch it. And so I started doing this TikTok dancing trend and I say stream English teacher and apparently it has quite seriously affected the numbers, and it's just sort of like people are saying it. They feel like they're watching like a bird do a mating call.
And you have used this to successfully market your relatively, I say, mainstream sitcom on Hulu, a big streaming service. Is this like going to become a thing? Are they going to go up like Kathy Bates, who's the star of the new Matlock reboot,
yeah,
and say,
yeah,
Kathy,
exactly.
we need
They're
you to
be
do
like,
something.
Please, Kathy, just do one I Love Your Daughter video. Come on.
It'll be amazing. I have to ask you, though, about another thing you are famous for. Apparently, you know they say he's big in Japan? Well, you are big in Australia because they right. think you, out of all the people who attempt it, do the best fake Australian accent. Is that
exactly.
the case?
Exactly. I have been on the news in Australia for how good my Australian accent is. And I've never been to Australia, actually.
Okay.
I've never
so, and your Australian character is a weightlifter of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Who yeah, Rick.
Rick.
Yeah, he's a weightlifter.
Right. And I think having set you up as the finest fake Australian accent, I think we need to hear from Rick or anyone else you might want to.
Okay. Okay. I don't know. I don't usually do it on the spot. I'm probably going to fail. So let me say that. But let me see. Hey guys, just wanted to say that I'm so glad we're all here together tonight, and it's a privilege to be able to talk to this crowd and to show off my amazing biceps and to lift kilos and lift so many kilos, something like that.
And I love the fact that somebody in Australia saw that and said, that man's a hero.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to bring him onto our air just to praise him for his fake... Is there a secret to your brilliant fake Australian accent?
Yes. It's not a secret. It's that I watched several seasons of Australia's Next Top Model. And one of the key phrases is this not such a nice thing to say, but is this guy was talking to one of the models and he goes, look, why stop? It's great, but waist down, you've got a lot of work to do because you're not going to fit the clothes. And if you don't fit the clothes, you don't get the job.
Wow, that was
amazing.
That's exactly the speech Peter gave me backstage.
Yeah. Well, Brian Jordan Alvarez, it is so much fun to talk to you, and we have asked you here to play a game we're calling
English Teacher, Meet an English Creature.
And by English creature, we of course mean the hedgehog. That adorable spiny thingamajig that's under severe threat because apparently we just can't have good things. Answer two or three questions about hedgehogs correctly, Brian, and you will win a prize for one of our listeners. A hedgehog. No, actually not that. A voice for their voicemail message. Bill, who is Brian Jordan Alvarez playing for?
Kate Smith of Orlando, Florida.
All right. Here's your first question. Hedgehogs, of course, are beloved in England. And in 2006, the Hedgehog Preservation Society, a real thing, won an important battle on behalf of the hedgehogs. Was it A, they won a court case that led to hedgehogs being legally classified as, quote, tiny, spiny persons? B, every town is required to have at least one hedgehog highway, a lane at the side of the road reserved for hedgehogs. Or C, they got McDonald's to redesign their McFlurry cups because hedgehogs kept getting stuck in them.
Oh, it's B or C. I think C.
You're right, Brian. That's what happened. It took 6 years of lobbying and presumably television commercials with sad hedgehogs with McFlurry cups on their heads, but it did work. McDonald's did change the design of their McFlurry
cups. Look, and we all miss the old McFlurry cup, but you got to.
It's all right, man. It's for the hedgehogs. Yeah. It's for the hedgehogs. Okay. Now, as we've established, English people love their hedgehogs, but maybe not as much as Americans do, who went so overboard for that animal that what happened in 2019? A, the American Kennel Club had to change their rules to officially exclude hedgehogs from being entered into the Westminster Dog Show. Mm. B, the CDC had to issue a warning that kissing your hedgehog could give you a rare form of salmonella. Or C, the Met Gala kept Zendaya from entering while wearing a cape made of 24 live hedgehogs.
Mm. I think it's B.
You think it's B. You're right. The CDC has put out a warning. Stop kissing your hedgehogs. It is not sanitary. Shake their paws firmly. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. You're doing very well, Brian. Hedgehogs are very familiar animals, but there are still some mysteries about them. For example, nobody knows why hedgehogs occasionally do what? A, refuse to eat anything but cheese pizza. B, blow up like a balloon. Or C, get into formation and do what really looks like a synchronized dance number.
I think it's, I could be wrong, but I think it's B.
Blowing up like a balloon. You're right.
Yeah. Wow.
They do that.
People do that sometimes,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, its technical name is balloon syndrome, and nobody knows exactly what causes it. It's very dangerous for the hedgehogs, and the cure, and I am very serious, is to deflate them.
Whoa.
Oh.
Bill, how did Brian Jordan Alvarez do in our show?
He has entered a rare group. Three in a row. Yes.
Congratulations.
Wow, Brian. Whoa.
Brian Jordan Alvarez is the creator, producer, writer, and, of course, star of English Teacher on Hulu. Brian Jordan
Alvarez.
Yes,
binge English Teacher on Hulu. Binge English
binge
Teacher.
Binge it. Do not sleep. Do not eat.
Come to Brazil, but I already went to Brazil. If you want me again, then I will.
In just a minute, Bill goes for gold in Mario Kart in the Listener Limerick Challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait Wait Don't Tell Me from NPR.
The English rock band The Cure broke into the pop music scene in the 1980s. Later, they took a 16-year break.
I sort of thought I'd written everything I had to write, but as it turns out, I haven't.
The return of The Cure on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition Monday morning from 5 to 9 o'clock here on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Burt Nash, offering a wide range of services for youth and their families, including therapy, parent support, and case management. More information at burtnash.org. and from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello tomorrow, 2 p.m. ticketlead.ku.edu. Cloudy skies today with a 90% chance of showers, maybe thunderstorms today. Highs in the lower 60s. It's 54 and raining in Topeka.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance, designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at subaru.com/wilderness. And Workday, with AI at the core of its system. Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We're playing this week with Luke Burbank, Emmy Blotnick, and Brian Babylon. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you so much. In just a minute, Bill finds it hard to hold a candle in the cold November rhyme. In our listener limerick challenge game, if you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Emmy, the New York Times this week made a plea to wedding planners to look out for a marginalized group of people at weddings. Who are those people?
Single people?
They are, in fact, the single people.
One of them is here.
Yes.
Yes, apparently. Single people, yes. Where everybody's there to celebrate true love between two people. But what about the sad spinsters? Not to mention, of course, the spinstos. This article recommends, for example, that people who are organizing weddings should cancel the slow dances because those can be hard for the people without a date. The article even mentioned one woman at a wedding who felt so awkward she tried to get on the slow dance floor by dancing around with her dinner roll. What a goof. I wonder why she's single.
Who goes to a wedding and makes it about them? Why would you? This is my day. How dare? No, I'm not.
Brian Zilla.
Yeah.
I also think that the premise, having been married a couple of times, not to brag, the premise that the single people are the sad people misunderstands yeah. the nature of some committed relationships.
Yeah.
Heading on home, doing whatever you want to do, is not a bad feeling compared to tense car ride home.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me...
Because someone tried to break out their moves to Jungle Fever.
Yeah. At your weddings, the number indeterminate at this point...
That's for the courts to decide.
You were there, getting married.
Yes.
Looking at the dateless people who were leaving alone going, those lucky bastards.
No. Not in those moments. But I'm just saying this cultural idea that we have to feel so bad for folks who are single, like their life is such a living hell. I would just say spend a Saturday morning with them and see how unhellish it is.
Yeah, they're asleep.
They're asleep.
Yeah.
They're chilling. Nobody is messing with them. It's a pretty good scene.
You know what? I will say I've been to some receptions and they put people at the single table. So it's that old auntie, a couple of teenagers, and a few single people. Throw some joints on that table and keep it stepping. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Do you catch a bouquet? Go home.
I'm just imagining, they throw the garter in the air or whatever they throw in the air, the bouquet, right? And some people are going, whoa.
Yeah.
Luke, managers have tried a variety of incentives to get employees back in the office even this long after the pandemic. Things like ping pong tables, massage chairs, but one company in Sweden may have topped them all by adding what feature?
Is it experiential? Is
yes.
it like some kind of a trampoline or slide? Or?
Oh, yes, a slide, very much like that. I'll give it to you. It's a roller coaster.
A roller coaster?
Yes. The Great Exhibition Design Studio, that's the name of the company, they made waves this week by becoming the first office in the world, as far as anyone knows, to feature a fully functional indoor roller coaster in the office. It's the perfect addition to lure back employees who love both fun and filing workmen's comp applications. The roller coaster, which has a 10-foot vertical drop and is 200 feet long along its course, can carry a single rider on a trip throughout the office, through the halls and the lunchroom and the workrooms, right by the desks of all the employees who were like, good Lord, Sven, I'm on a Zoom call. Could you not?
I like the idea that if you go to this company's website, everyone's profile pic is that photo they sell you at the end.
Exactly.
What have you got? Do they do that like when you get laid off? Like you just get into the roller coaster and then you look up, you're at your car with your box.
That would be
stuff.
Nice.
Like,
yeah.
Right?
It seems like it would be, I guess, a good way to wake yourself up if it was like you're hitting that logy point in the day.
Yeah.
But it also
yeah.
seems like a tremendously poor use of the space of the office building.
Well, especially for just one person.
Yeah.
One
yeah.
person at a time. Don't you want to do that with your friends?
That's even more important.
Well, you can wave to them.
Friendship?
No, a one-person roller coaster sounds dumb.
What does the company manufacture or sell or do?
They're a design company.
Oh.
They do, like, design installation. So it's you know.
On brand.
It's less surprising than if it were, say, a payroll processing company.
It would be
company.
Great if it was, like, Safeco Insurance.
Yeah, exactly. Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can catch us most weeks at the Studebaker Theater in downtown Chicago, or you can come see us on the road in Detroit on November 14th and at Carnegie Hall in New York City on December 12th. For tickets and information, go to nprpresents.org. Also, you can check out our sister podcast, How to Do Everything. This week, Mike and Ian talked to two of your kids' favorite celebrities, Josh Gad from Frozen and the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hello, this is Jenna from Cincinnati.
What do you do there in Cincinnati?
I am a project engineer for a large steel company and mom to a rambunctious 3-year-old son.
How very cool. And I'm not talking about the son. I got one of those. Big deal. I'm talking about the steel because, you know, it's the modern world. People call in. They're teachers. They're consultants. They're IT professionals. You make something.
Yeah, it's really actually kind of cool.
Right. Do you like take steel home from the office?
I can't say yes or no.
Right. Well, Jenna, welcome to the show. Bill Curtis is going to read you 3 news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. He'll stop suddenly. That's when you'll know it's your turn to fill in that last word. And if you do that 2 times out of 3, you'll be a winner. Ready to play?
Yeah, let's go.
Here is your first limerick.
Though the slime factor's making me chokra, for my health, I am going for brokra. For the good of my bod, I'm distilling green pods, and I'm drinking the water from...
okra.
Okra, yes. Okra is the... In a new health trend that is supposedly going to lower your blood pressure and aid your digestion, people online are drinking something called okra water.
I was worried we were drinking Oprah.
No.
There's only 2 ways that limerick ends.
Pretty much. Oprah would have been better. Okra water is, I am sorry to report, exactly what it sounds like. It's the perfect drink for anyone who's looked at, you know, water and thought, sure, this is good, but couldn't it be more mucilaginous? So to make okra water, you just leave lots of slices of okra in water overnight, and then in the morning you throw out the okra and you drink the bitter, gloppy liquid that's left over. The trend started after someone said, you know, I'd like to drink my own snot, but there's not enough of it.
What if Rocky Balboa did that in the morning?
He never would have had a boxing career. He
never
put it down,
yeah.
Walked away. That's too gross.
Gaston from Beauty and the Beast makes raw eggs in his okra water.
Yeah.
No one's thick as Gaston.
So is this
no
this
one slimes like Gaston.
All right, Jenna, here is your next limerick.
Though the internet answered with rage, I did not lock my tot in a cage. I merely chose paint that is boring and faint. Now the baby's room's color is...
Age?
Beige, yes, that's right. Instead of the bright primary colors that we're all used to with children's stuff, more and more baby toys and decor and clothing is being made in beige and other neutral colors. Even the beloved TV character Bluey has become beigey.
Well, there is a shortage of accountants in America, and the only way to get more of them is raise them in a beige bedroom
right.
with babies.
Here is your last limerick.
Though not buff, I won't fave any shaming. With controllers on screens, I am aiming. New Olympic events will appear 4 years hence. I'll be getting a medal in...
gaming.
Yes.
Yes, very good.
Three in a row. Wow.
An official at the International Olympic Committee said recently that they, quote, cannot ignore the staggering numbers, unquote, of video game players out there. So video games will probably be added to the Olympics sometime in the near future, say by 2032, when the top medal winners in the games will be the U.S., China, and the Mushroom Kingdom.
So this is going to replace, because they break dance and clearly came and went. So
thanks, Ray Gun.
Yeah.
Bill, how did Jenna do in our quiz?
Jenna is solid as steel. Three in a row.
Congratulations, Jenna.
Woo. Thank you all so much.
Jenna, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Now it's time for our final game, Lightning Fill-in-the-Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as they can. Each correct answer is now worth 2 points. Bill, can you give us the scores?
Luke has 4. Emmy and Brian each have 2.
All right. So I'm just going to arbitrarily choose Brian to go first. Here we go. The clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill in the blank.
Okay.
On Monday, federal authorities started an investigation into the fires that destroyed blanks in Oregon and Washington.
Wildfires.
No ballot boxes this time.
They were like wild in there.
On Tuesday, the CDC confirmed that 15 people contracted E. coli linked to food from blank.
McDonald's?
Yes. On Wednesday, rescue workers confirmed that 1,200 people were still trapped after Spain experienced massive disastrous blanking.
Floods.
Right. Saying they pose a risk to their health, schools throughout the country are banning students from blanking.
Texting.
No, wearing Crocs, the shoes. On Monday, Apple unveiled the first features of their new blank feature.
Artificial intelligence?
Yes, Apple Intelligence is called. Best known for her roles in Young Frankenstein and Tootsie, blank passed away at the age of 79.
Damn. Terry Garr?
Right. This week, a pizzeria in Wisconsin apologized to customers after they ran out of cooking oil and ended up using blank instead.
French fry oil.
No, cannabis oil. You know how it is, you run out of oil for your pizza you're making in a communal kitchen and accidentally you grab the bottle that somebody else was using to make pot brownies. About 70 customers reported getting super high after eating the pizza, which is, of course, the reverse order of the way it usually happens. Things got even worse when the restaurant ran out of those little Parmesan cheese packets and thought, well, we'll just send these little baggies of white powder instead.
Yeah.
Bill, how did Brian do in our quiz?
4 right, 8 more points. A total of 10 puts him in the lead.
All right. Emmy, you're up next. Here we go. Fill in the blank. According to a new report, Elon Musk has been in regular contact with blank for at least 2 years.
Putin.
Right. After serving 120 days in prison, former Trump chief of staff blank was released on Monday.
Steve Bannon.
Right. This week, the Los Angeles Dodgers beat the New York Yankees to win their 8th blank championship.
World Series?
Right. On Wednesday, Starbucks announced they would no longer charge extra for blank.
Like one of those alt milks?
Right. Yes, non-dairy milks. This week, a group of skateboarders fulfilled the wishes of their recently deceased friend by blanking.
Quitting?
No, by turning his headstone into a quarter-pipe skating ramp. For the first time in 130 years, the peaks of Mount Fuji in Japan don't have any blank on them in October.
Snow.
Right. Passengers flying from Seattle to Anchorage were outraged this month after a man blanked while in flight.
From Seattle to Anchorage.
Not important.
Okay. All right.
Not even sure why I mentioned it.
What did he do, Peter?
He opened a can of tuna.
Oh, no.
So a TikToker named Allie Jackson was sitting there, and she started filming when the person sitting next to her just reached into his bag, pulled out a can of tuna, popped it open, and just started eating it with a fork. The smell quickly filled up the plane, which was terrible for everyone except that family of cats traveling in row 34. Bill, how did Emmy do in our quiz?
Really good. 5 right, 10 more points. Her total of 12 puts her in the lead.
All right.
So how many, then, does Luke Burbank need to win?
4 to tie, 5 to win.
Not impossible, Luke. Here we go. Ready? This is for the game. Fill in the blank. After their opinion editor was prevented from publishing a presidential endorsement by their owner, over 250,000 people canceled their subscription to the blank.
Washington Post.
Right. In a move that sparked international outcry, Israel banned the UN group supporting refugees from blank.
Gaza.
Right. This week, several economic experts confirmed that America has managed to avoid a blank.
Recession.
Right. On Monday, a new rule went into effect requiring airlines to automatically refund passengers whose flights are blanked.
Delayed.
Right. Or canceled. This week, a Canadian man was arrested for driving under the influence after he was caught blanking.
Drinking maple syrup.
No, driving a Zamboni into the sides of an ice rink while dressed as a kangaroo. On Thursday, the USDA announced plans to test raw milk for blank.
Botulism.
No, bird flu. After months of complaints online about their portion sizes, blank announced they were returning to, quote, consistent and generous portions.
Chipotle?
Right, after residents of the UK started posting pictures of the Northern Lights on social media, authorities revealed that blank.
It was a children's drawing of the Northern Lights.
No, they're actually just the light shining up from a tomato factory. A recent solar storm has caused the aurora borealis to be visible far closer to the equator than any time in recent history. Sadly, this, though, was not that. This was the lights from the plant over there that processed tomatoes. If you're wondering how to tell the difference, the clues were the glow in the sky was shining upwards and it was red, and some observers reported the moon hitting their eye like a big pizza pie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Bill, did Luke do well enough to win?
5 right, 10 more points, 14 gives him the win.
Good job, Luke. In just a minute, we'll ask our panelists, now that we know that animals drink alcohol, what will be the next surprising vice that we learn they have? But first, let me tell you all that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, benevolent overlord, Philip Gotica writes our limericks. Our public address announcer is Paul Friedman. Our tour manager is Shayna Donald. Special thanks this week to our old friend Gary Yek. And thanks, as always, to the staff and crew at the Studebaker Theater. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Jennifer Mills, Miles Dornbos, and Lillian King. Special thanks to Blythe Robertson and Monica Hickey. Our intimacy coordinator is Peter Gwynn. Emma Choi is our vibe curator. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our CFO is Colin Miller. Our production manager is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, that's Michael Danforth. Now, panel, what wild things will animals be getting up to? Brian Babylon.
It comes to find out that McGruff, the crime dog, has been selling drugs the whole time.
That's what he keeps under the trench coat. Makes perfect sense. Emmy Blotnick.
Horses are doing human tranquilizers.
And Luke Burbank.
They'll become addicted to gambling, but the slot machines, when they come up cherries, it will be actual cherries.
Well, if any of that happens, we're going to ask you about it right here on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you so much, Bill Curtis. Thanks to Brian Babylon, Emmy Blotnick, and Luke Burbank. Thanks to our fabulous audience who came out to see us at the Studebaker Theater. And thanks to all of you for listening out there, wherever you might be. I'm Peter Sagal, and we'll see you next week. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Coming up next here on KPR, it's the Moth Radio Hour, storytelling without a net. Support for the Moth Radio Hour and Kansas Public Radio comes from the Midwest Trust Center, presenting Hiprov, starring Colin Mochrie and Asad Mekki, tomorrow evening, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
The only thing I was really worried about was what I was going to wear. All my favorite comedians were fly, but they all wore leather. Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Chris Rock, all well-groomed men who wore leather, and I didn't have leather ones, so I had to make shift what I had. So the night of the show, I'm walking down to the student strutting.
Next up, the Moth Radio Hour. I'm your host, Jody Powell. In this hour, stories of going against the grain, from a young comedian to a middle schooler to the daughter of a style icon.
When I was in my mid-teens, I started to investigate my own sense of style. And there was this antique clothing store, and there were all these amazing dresses that just hung on the walls. I mean, this place was magic.
That story and more coming up next on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Justice Department says it plans to send monitors to polling places in 27 states for Election Day next week to monitor compliance with federal voting rights laws. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The Justice Department enforces federal laws that protect the right to vote. As part of that mission, it regularly sends staff to monitor polling places. This year, the department says it is sending monitors to 86 jurisdictions in 27 states. On Election Day itself, Justice Department personnel will be available to field questions and complaints about possible violations of federal voting rights laws. That includes statutes that prohibit voter intimidation and voter suppression, as well as laws that ensure access to the polls for people with disabilities. It says complaints about violence, threats of violence, or intimidation at polling places should first be reported immediately to local authorities. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Texas has told the Justice Department it will not allow federal monitors at its polling places, saying the state has its own procedures to ensure free and fair elections. A federal jury in Louisville found former police detective Brett Hackinson guilty of violating Breonna Taylor's rights when she was killed by police in 2020. Amina Elahi of Louisville Public Media reports.
The decision came hours after jurors indicated they were deadlocked on the charge. Hankison was part of the raid in which police shot and killed Taylor in her home. Prosecutors say he fired into Taylor's apartment building through a covered door and window with no line of sight to the inside. Hankison faces a maximum of life in prison and will be sentenced in March. So far, it's the only conviction of an officer who executed the search warrant at Taylor's apartment. Her death fueled mass protests in 2020, calling for racial justice and police accountability. The jury also returned a not guilty verdict for a second count of civil rights violations, which focused on Taylor's neighbors. For NPR News, I'm Amina Elahi in Louisville.
The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has announced the deployment of 10,000 more soldiers and police to join the rescue operation in Valencia after this week's flash flooding and landslides. He's heard here through a BBC interpreter.
In total, we're talking about the biggest deployment of emergency services and the army that we have ever deployed in peacetime in our country. This deployment has already made 4,800 rescues and helped over 30,000 people, rescuing them from homes, roads, and flooded industrial estates. Unfortunately, the scope of this disaster means that this is not enough. We know that aid is taking time to reach certain locations. There are still garages and homes that are blocked, and people are still trapped.
211 people are confirmed dead. Dozens are still missing. This is NPR News in Washington. The Serbian government declared a day of mourning today. A roof collapsed at the entrance to a railway station in a northern city yesterday, killing 14 people. Officials are promising a thorough investigation. The station has been renovated twice in recent years. The Serbian opposition is calling for protests, accusing the government of corruption and excessive red tape. The World Health Organization is resuming its polio vaccine campaign today to bring a second dose to children in northern Gaza. It was postponed last week by health officials concerned about safety and the heavy Israeli bombardment in the area. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The polio vaccine requires two doses to effectively stop transmission. When the first dose was administered in the north back in September, Israel assured humanitarian pauses across the area. But this time, there will only be a pause in Gaza City. Israeli officials say that's because other areas in the north have been mostly evacuated. But the WHO says around 15,000 children who need the second dose remain in northern areas that are inaccessible. Israeli forces have besieged parts of northern Gaza for weeks, saying Hamas has regrouped there. The second dose of the vaccine was administered in other parts of Gaza last month. That campaign was largely successful. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Britain's Conservative Party elected a new leader today. Kemi Badenoch is the first black woman to head a major British political party. She replaces Rishi Sunak. He stepped down after the Conservatives lost more than 200 seats in parliamentary elections in July. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include National Geographic documentary films presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship. Now streaming on Hulu and Disney+.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm your host, Jody Powell. I came across an image recently with a school of fish heading downstream towards what seemed like calmer waters. And in the middle, there was one fish who was going against the current upstream. The journey required a bit more effort, and our friend was alone but still traveling onwards. That fish got me thinking about stories where people will themselves to go in a different direction or try something new or maybe learn a lesson the hard way. They risk hearing the words, "I told you so," but hope at least to say, "I did it my way." So, in this episode, stories of swimming against the current. Our first story comes from Jameer Pond. Jameer told this at our Play It Again Slam, a night where we celebrate stories we've heard, loved, and wanted you to hear too. This was told in New York City, where WNYC is a media partner of The Moth. Here's Jameer.
Okay.
Hey, y'all. How you doing? It's the first week of college at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. And I'm standing in the Student Union building, and my eyes are locked on a flyer on the wall. The flyer has a microphone on it, and in big black bold letters, it says, "Sign up for the Dumb Whack Talent Show." And I say, "Hell yes." Why wouldn't I, right? I'm looking at the time for some popularity. I wanted all of the clout, and I knew that this would be my first step forward. Plus, I would get to be crowned king of comedy at Lincoln University. I was a stand-up comedian at the time for 3 years. I first graced the stage at 14 years old in a program sponsored by the Gotham Comedy Club called Kids in Comedy. And I wasn't real popular in high school, but on that stage, that was like my safe haven, where I could be the most comfortable and free. From 14 to 17, I developed this tight 10-minute act that was destroying rooms all over New York City. Now, I can't remember all of my jokes, but I definitely remember one being about my mom throwing big words at me that I didn't understand in arguments. Like, she was like, "Jameer, you are monopolizing the phone, Jameer. You are monopolizing the phone." I didn't understand what Mr. Monopoly had to do with using a house phone. But I was pissed. My favorite joke that I remember was like my opening joke. It was the one that set everything off. And it had to do with teenage dating. And just dating girls at the time who had no boo taste while I had McDonald's pockets. And so this was like a natural progression for me. This would be my first road show. So I signed up for the Dumb Whack Talent Show. Now, it was about a week out, so I didn't have a lot of time to promote. So I told a whole bunch of my newfound friends and my crush at the time. I called her Lavender because she looked like an older version of Lavender from Matilda. Big glasses, freckles, brown skin, beautiful smile. And when she said, yes, I will attend, I said, of course you will, because who's going to stand next to me while I get coronated the king of comedy at Lincoln University? As you can tell, I was pretty confident. The only thing I was really worried about was what I was going to wear. All my favorite comedians were fly, but they all wore leather. Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Chris Rock, all well-groomed men who wore leather, and I didn't have leather money. So I had to make shift what I had. So the night of the show, I'm walking down to the student union. I'm strutting down to the student union building in my crisp white polo shirt with blue stripes on it, some real dark denim jeans, and my white and blue patent leather Air Force Ones. I was clean, y'all. Thank you, okay. Y'all so gracious. I didn't have probably the cologne or smell goods that they had, but I did have my dad's half-used bottle of Jupe. And I sprayed that in the air. So now I'm clean, confident, and smelling like a 58-year-old divorcee. I was ready. I get to the backstage of the sub where all the talent is, and there's a camera crew from the local Lincoln television station, and they asked if they can interview me, and I said, sure. And I gave them my introduction. I'm Jameer Pond. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm going to be famous one day, and I'm going to make Lincoln a lot of money. And the girl behind the camera was like, oh, okay, excuse me. And I said, you excuse? The confidence had kind of teetered over to cocky, but I said what I said, and I stood on it. Finally, the MC of the show calls my name. He said, we got Jameer Pond coming up next. He's going to do a little comedy for y'all. You know, give him a round of applause. And as I'm walking up the stairs, I hear a scattered round of applause, and I stand on stage, and the first thing I noticed, it is really bright in here. Now, usually I'm doing clubs and venues like this where I could barely see my hands. At this point in the student union building, I'm seeing over 300 plus black people faces, and they all had the same, you better be funny face. I was slightly nervous, I can't lie. But when I looked over to the right, I saw my friends that I had asked to come, and I saw Lavender. And she gave me a thumbs up and mouthed, good luck, Boo. And I said, thank you, Boo. And that's all I needed. I grabbed the microphone confidently. I placed the mic stand behind me, and I proceeded with my joke. Here's my joke face. Okay, hey. Hey, y'all. You know, dating's really tough. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I had a girl come up to me and say, Jameer, if you want to date me, you got to pay for my hair, pay for my nails, and buy me some jewelry. I looked at her like she was crazy. Now, here's the punchline. I got $2.50 in my pocket. You better decide whether you want cheese on your burger or not. And the room was more silent than this. I had to check the microphone to see if it was on. Because usually when I get to $2.50, people are holding their sides. But as I'm looking at the 300 plus black people faces, they are all blank and kind of looking at me like, where are the jokes? I'm standing on stage in silence. It felt like the longest time ever. Finally, a gentleman stands up in the middle of the crowd. We lock eyes. He looks at me and leans in and says, "Boo!" and sits back down. It's like a dagger hit my chest. I had never been booed before, let alone single booed. Suddenly, droves of people begin to boo my soul out my body. Now, it's bad enough to get booed. It's even worse when you gotta look your boo-ees in the eye. I'll never forget this girl, Dominique. I had math class with her. I will never forget her hands clasped up against her mouth, yelling, "Boo! You suck!" We was just doing A squared plus B squared plus C squared together. I look over at Lavender, and she no longer has on a winning smile or the thumbs up. It's more like, yeesh. I don't know if I want to be around for this coronation of this king. I was too nervous, because I had never been booed before, to start any jokes up. I stood on stage and watched people actively boo me until I finally got sick and tired of it, and I ran off stage. I know, right? As I'm running through the building, I'm thinking, I hope I don't run into that camera crew again, because I'm sure they got some questions for me. I ran all the way back to my dorm, depressed, embarrassed, hurt, and still smelling like a 58-year-old divorcee who lost everything at this point now. I just got a cat with me now. And I stayed in my room for 3 days because I wanted to evade the barrage of those constant boos that I still had in my head. And finally, I left my room. Not because I wanted to, but because I had class. It was Monday. I still had 3.998 years left on campus. And I got the popularity I wanted. Oh yeah, I sure did. For the rest of the semester, people would hurl insults using the line cheeseburger at the end to talk about me. Hey, there go that cheeseburger, bull. Ain't nothing funny about bull. I'm like, I'm right here, y'all. I can hear and see y'all. Talk about me. I no longer wanted the big clout. I found a crew of people who I finally settled down and just became one of the guys, you know. 2 years later, Lavender and I finally did date. She had to let the stink off of me. Getting booed took 2 years, y'all. But I learned from that, like, not to take my gift for granted. Like, I was cocky, and because I had done these amazing things in New York, I didn't read my audience. I didn't take the time to put the craft in, and I reap what I sowed. But the biggest lesson that I walk away with and I give to y'all is that if you ever see a show of talent that has the words dumb or whack in them, turn the other way. Thank you.
That was Jameer Pond. Jameer is a New York-based live and visual storyteller and creative video director for Vanity Fair. Jameer kindly took some time to chat with me about the world of comedy and how he looked back at that moment on stage.
How did you kind of bounce back from that? Mm. Maybe there's time, maybe there are other elements that you apply, probably whenever you go to a stage again. But like, how do you bounce back when you kind of just like fall and completely flat?
All right. Well, this was catastrophic. And this might be possibly the worst thing you go through. And now looking at in terms of being on stage, and now look at that and go, okay, well, if that's one of the worst, you know, you already got it out early. I will say, while I stopped doing stand-up traditionally at Lincoln University, over the years, I started becoming hosts for events, and I started to become a part of the radio station, and I got my outlet out in different ways. Even though I was embarrassed to do stand-up again, I was able to still connect with people in similar ways. A lot less pressure, too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like the big lesson, your big takeaway from that moment is that when you go on stage, mattering not what you're doing, you have to prepare.
You got to prepare.
Whether it's story or stand-up or whatever else it is.
You got to prepare.
How do you prepare for the stage now?
I'll practice out loud. I'll say lines. I'll put together ideas in my home and then come on the stage. We're like, all right, you know what? Let's shift this here and put this here. It's like a lot of editing, self-editing in my head. And so I'll write down like concept and ideas, but then like really just internalize it and bring it to the stage.
Got it.
Yeah.
In the story, your fit, your
my
outfit,
yeah.
How you looked was super, super important.
Yes.
Right? Is it as important now on the storytelling stage? And if so, what is your getup? What do you put on when you go on stage?
You know what? It's actually like I spend a lot less time planning like what I'm going to look like on stage, which, you know, I'm thankful because I got a pretty decent closet of like fly things. But I like to be comfortable on stage.
If you could do it all again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have another joke in your back pocket, or would you kind of bust out in a story? Would you have changed your role right then on stage? What would you have done differently besides obviously prepare differently?
Yeah. I think in hindsight, looking how everything turned out, I wouldn't do a thing differently. But I will say one thing that I did learn from that experience is to always read the room. To always look at, like, who's in the audience, how they're reacting to certain things. How hard do I have to go above and beyond? And that really helps me assess my own energy and how I approach it.
Got it. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Jameer.
Thank you so much, Jody.
Appreciate you.
I appreciate you.
That was Jameer Pond. After the break, a young girl's idea of who an idol is changes. That's when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
This show is supported by Progressive Insurance. Looking for a career you'll love with flexibility, great pay and benefits, and one of the country's top workplaces? Come join our growing team. Go to progressive.com/careers and apply online today.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Today on 105 Live, we've got a live session at the Bottleneck in Lawrence with musical connections to Celina, Lindsberg, and Lawrence. The Draper Family Band features three generations of musicians and the father-son duo of Kansas Music Hall of Fame's Paul Draper and Brandon Draper. Join Nick Carswell for in-studio conversation and live tracks on 105 Live today at 5 o'clock. On Kansas Public Radio. Cloudy skies, a good chance of rain if you're not getting it already, a 90% chance of rain in the forecast for this weekend. It's 56 in Lawrence, 57 and raining in Emporia.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jody Powell. In this hour, we're hearing stories of going by your own rules. Next up is Srishti Karki. Srishti told this story at our Moths Education Showcase held at the Culture Lab in Queens. Here's Srishti.
Ever since I was a child, I had to write essays about my idols. And I would always write about these powerful Nepali women, like Pasanglamu Sherpa or Anuradha Koirala, women who have achieved heroic feats like climbing the Mount Everest or tackling human trafficking. And I would always see my friends write about their aunts, their grandmas, or their moms. But to me, my mom was just an ordinary woman. My mom is a middle school teacher to underprivileged kids, so it didn't help that we had the exact same schedule. We often woke up at the same time, we went to school at the same time, we came back home at the same time. Ironically, she spent her evenings in clubs like JC's or the Lions Club International, clubs that dedicate their time and resources towards social work. But because I never got to see her work firsthand, I didn't view her as exceptional. Hey, maybe I was a bit jealous. My mom spent her entire day with other kids in her school and her entire evenings with friends at clubs. Anyway, one day, she asked my dad to teach her how to drive, which was unexpected. Living in a small valley in Nepal, women in our community didn't drive. None of her friends drove. Some drove scooters, but never a car. My dad was a businessman who spent 12 to 14 hours a day working. And when he heard about this, he was ecstatic. The women in my mom's generation were the first to start working, but their motivations never really extended towards driving. So I was so surprised to see my dad being so supportive. But my dad was the kind of man that said, if you want to learn how to swim, just jump into the river. And that's exactly what he did. He took my mom directly to the road. And she did not like it. So she took matters into her own hands. Not wanting to start her journey in midst of a busy road, she started to take the car out in the afternoons in these small alleys or dead ends, driving back and forth every day until she felt confident enough. I used to watch her drive from our balcony, and seeing her relentless effort, I really wanted her to learn. But then I would see her stumble every time there would be a person or like a motorcycle trying to pass by in a tiny road that barely fit her car. But when she was confident enough, she took me and my sister on a long drive. Sitting in the passenger seat, strapping my seatbelt, I sat there like a hawk, making sure she's not tailgating, checking the side mirrors, turning my head every so often to check the blind spots. But that's when I noticed her unwavering attention to the road. Balancing the brakes, claws, and accelerator, she was driving so smoothly. In a city free of traffic lights, traffic signals, or zebra crossings, amidst a busy road, she was navigating beautifully. I felt so proud seeing my mom break cultural barriers with something as simple as driving. That's when I asked her what motivated her to drive all of a sudden. And she replied that she wanted to make more time for us. Because Dad was always busy, going out meant he would have to drop us off in the morning and pick us up late at night. Or sometimes we'd leave at 9 p.m., an hour before closing. So her driving would give us the freedom to plan outings on our convenience. And that meant everything to me. Not only was she breaking generational barriers, she was doing so for us. But the first time driving was only one of many. In the upcoming weeks, we went on shopping sprees, we went to eat out, and within months, there weren't any significant monuments, be it hills, the rivers, the lakes, the temples that we hadn't ventured. And we made sure to include our 3 aunts and 7 little cousins. All of us compact in one single car. We would visit our relatives, ones that we often didn't get to see, sometimes because of the different schedules, and sometimes just the distances. My life became a vibrant mosaic, incomplete without all these people that I never imagined would be important to me one day. Ever since then, I've taken the time to look more into her work. Teaching middle school students is not an easy job. After 8 hours of work, putting oneself out there to build community is remarkable. My mom has redefined heroism for me. It isn't the intent to achieve the improbable that makes you a hero, but the way you can improve the lives of others at any scale. With something as simple as driving, my mom was able to lift restrictions for me and my sister. What was so hard for us is so achievable. It's just a mere skill for us. Years later, we moved from Nepal to America. And my mom was the first to go to the DMV and get her license. Even before my father. She was the first to drive us to the city. Crossing the Brooklyn Bridge, the iconic skyline, the tall buildings illuminated in the nightlight, and seeing my mom drive in the city of dreams, I felt the same joy and pride I had felt the first time she took us on a drive. So looking back, even though I never wrote essays about my mom as a child, I will share her story as my idol every chance I get. Thank you.
That was Srishti Karki. Srishti is a high school senior living in Queens, New York. We met Srishti in our Summer Moth Story Lab program in partnership with Apex for Youth, South Asian Youth Action, and Woodside on the Move. Srishti just got her learner's permit and is also learning to drive. The night Srishti told the story, her mom was in the audience, and the audience gave her a huge round of applause. Srishti said her mother was very emotional after the education showcase and told her that she wasn't aware that her daughter had been observing her learning process. Srishti said, "My mom did not think I would be interested as I was pretty young, but she was really happy hearing me recite the details." To see some photos of Srishti and her family, head over to themoth.org. Our next story is told by Shannon Scarsaletta. Shannon told this at a New York City Story Slam.
So, the summer before my 6th grade, I received a letter from my new middle school that said that the way that my middle school was going to let us, like the new class was all getting to know each other, was to have us do a ropes course together, like an obstacle course. And I was psyched. Because this was a new group of people, and I wanted to be one of the popular girls, and I wanted, like, a hot middle school boyfriend, and I knew this was my chance, because there is nothing that gets you in with the popular kids more than complete and total physical domination of your classmates, right? Like, So I was pretty certain that that was within my wheelhouse, because usually, like, at this point in a story, I would probably tell you something like, I wasn't always the 6 foot, 180 pound, size 10, 36 D goddess standing in front before you right now. But I stopped growing when I was 11. So I was always the 6 foot, 36 D, 180 pound goddess standing in front of you today. Yeah. and just to let that sink in, I, at 11 years old, was taller than your dad. That's true. So I looked exactly like how I do now, except I had this like short Meg Ryan cropped little haircut, which my mom said was cute, but that's not usually a word you associate with a 6'11" year old. It's more of a word like haunting or teacher, which, by the way, my classmates thought I was on that first day at that obstacle course. In fact, one of the boys in my class came up to me and handed me a note from his parents, which is true. But it was okay because he was the hottest boy I have ever seen. His name was Matt Felzer, and he had spiky gelled hair. Like, remember that? Like, where it went forward and then straight up. He had like that forward straight up hair, and he had a puka shell necklace on, and he was like 4'5" of sexy fifth grade, sixth grade goodness. And I was like, I am here for this. And we totally vibed once it was clear that I was 11 as well. And So the race started, and by the way, it turned out that Matt was on my team. So I was like, oh my God, this is my moment to show my sheer physical dominance, because there's nothing that middle school boys find more attractive than being emasculated on a field of battle. So the gun went off, or probably a whistle. In my mind, it was a gun. And I started, and I was like high kneeing through the tires, and I was like, you know, like army crawling, like marine crawling through the field, and I was like literally 20 feet ahead of like any one of my teammates at this point, which was great because all the like middle school boys who were behind me like clearly had a wonderful view of my butt. And I was like, yes, they're definitely fighting over me, but I'm gonna stay with Matt because that was my first love. So it's totally okay. So I was kicking ass through this whole thing up until the final obstacle. And the final obstacle was a wall. And for those of you who don't speak obstacle course, what this looks like is there is an 8-foot wall in front of you. And the object of the obstacle is for everyone on one side, your team, to work together and collaborate to get every single person over the wall to the other side. Now, here's the thing. I get up to the wall, and I notice that all my tiny little classmates are trying to get over this wall. And I'm like, oh, my God. I got this. So I'm like, get over, Matt. And I'm like, and I like throw him on over. And I'm like, come on, Adam. And like Adam goes over, and like Phil goes over. And I'm like Marissa, go. And like Marissa just flew over. And I'm like, I got this. And I got everyone over the wall. And then I am the last one on the other side of the wall. And the object at this point of the exercise is for the people on top of the wall to hoist the last person up over that wall, and I am looking up at a group of 70-pound children with arms like paper bags, and I'm like, there's no way in hell this is gonna happen, and I froze. And I totally froze. And the reason I froze was not just because the physical improbability of me getting over that wall, but also because I was feeling a brand new feeling. And that was the first time in my life that I felt a feeling that I would feel every time I would hear the word butch, or every time I would hear the word monster, or every time I would hear the word giraffe, in middle school and high school and into college. And that feeling was shame. I was feeling shame in my body for being the person who was too big to do the obstacle course. Now, the good thing about being Shannon Scarsoletta is that I feel no feeling stronger than the need to win. So I noticed that the competing teams were starting to do that weird like monkey barrel thing where they were just like somehow getting their tiny bodies over this, over this thing. And I was like, you know what? I have to fucking do this. So I took a few steps back. And I did have Air Jordans on. I just want you to know that. So I took a few steps back and a couple of running leaps and hurled my body onto this 8-foot wall. And somehow these tiny little boys whose arms were like the equivalent of like, you know, the like outside the car dealership people, like somehow they like grabbed me long enough that I could grasp my giant hands over the top of this board, and I hoisted my own body weight above this thing like the tiny marine I was, and I got myself to the other side of that wall, and my team won. My team won. Yeah. And I mean, I wish I could tell you that, like, that was a day I, like, never felt worse about my body again. But, I do want to say, that I love my body. And, I love it not despite, but because of how powerful I am. And my 6'8" husband loves this big ass body as well. And in fact, the moment he fell in love with me was when he watched me play Division I basketball, sweating my ass off against the Harvard women's basketball team. So I was onto something as a sixth grader.
That was Shannon Scarsaletta. Shannon is an executive coach, storyteller, and improv comedian. She lives in Houston, Texas with her very tall family, including her wonderful husband, Michael, and two beautiful kids, Luis and Carmen. I asked her if she had any updates. She said, nope, still tall. In a moment, a storyteller brings us along to some special outings with some fabulous outfits. That's when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from I2S at KU, developing and researching new technologies, educating technology professionals, and providing service to the region and nation. More at i2s.research.ku.edu. We've got 17 more minutes of the Moth Radio Hour, then stay with us for This American Life coming up at noon today. Today on This American Life, what small thing gives you a tiny shred of hope? Stories of trying to bridge the political divide. That's on This American Life at noon on Kansas Public Radio.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jody Powell. In this episode, we've been listening to stories of going against the grain and doing things a little or a lot differently. Our final story comes from Gina Belafonte, who first came to us via the community workshop we did with Daughters of the Movement. Gina went on to tell the story at our main stage at the theater at the Ace Hotel in Los Angeles, where we partnered with public radio station KCRW. Here's Gina Belafonte.
Growing up in New York City, in the 1960s and 70s, Upper West Side, the liberal mecca of Manhattan, my parents would organize meetings and throw parties that would go on way past my bedtime. I can still hear the hushed tones and the burst of laughter from my father coming from the living room, and the sound of the rhythm of the click in my mother's ankle as she would walk down the very long hallway, past my bedroom into hers, ice clinking in the glass of her cocktail. I knew big things were going on down the hall, and I so wanted to be a part of them. You see, my parents were very busy people. They were two of many strategists, architects, and funders of the 1960s civil rights movement. And they were both accomplished artists in their own right. And they were super busy. They were going out all the time or entertaining at home. And in preparation for these events, I would quietly, so as not to disturb her, tiptoe into my parents' brown wallpapered bathroom, covered in mirrors, and just perch myself on the bidet. I would just stare up at my mom in raptured fascination, as she would put on her face, as she would call it. I watched her as she smoked her Philip Morris filtered cigarettes in between makeup applications and sipped her, at that time, scotch on the rocks. I studied as she took the black Maybelline eyebrow pencil and made that perfectly curved arch and perfect eyeliner and wings and the L'Oreal burgundy lip liner that she would etch the borders of her mouth and fill in with that frosted, beautiful pink. Oh, perfection. Oh, I just adored her. She was the most beautiful and fascinating woman in the world to me. And these were stolen moments for me, because my mom was busy. She was living that big life. I mean, she got written up in a magazine saying that she was one of the best-dressed women of Manhattan. I know, really, and you can imagine going out 2 to 3 times a week puts a heavy burden on a wardrobe. But she would gift me some of these clothes, and I loved it. But as a young adult, there was a few that were a little inappropriate for my age. But hey, this was the 70s, you know, women's lib and all. And if I were going to go out with her to any of these events, she would ensure that my appearance was on par with hers. I mean, my mother, she dressed to the nines, whether it was a tailored suit for the meeting of a head of state, or a gala nose gown to a award show, or a African dashiki to a drumming circle. My mother knew exactly what to wear. So she made sure that I looked good too. And she referred to me as her clone, which was a title that I so cherished and wore with pride. When I was in my mid-teens, I started to investigate my own sense of style, much to my mother's chagrin. And there was this incredible antique clothing store in my neighborhood called Jezebel's. And there were all these amazing antique dresses that just hung on the walls. I mean, this place was magic. There were old piano shawls that just slumbered over the standing lamps of this heavily kilim and Persian carpeted floor. And there were racks and racks of clothes, antique dresses, old Hawaiian shirts, wide leg khaki pants from the 40s. And this all became my new sense of style, sort of this bohemian chic. And I remember coming home one day after hanging out with my friends, and my mother greeted me at the door, now vodka in hand. It was 5 o'clock somewhere. And she took one look at me and she said, "What are you wearing?" In a very poor attempt at trying to defend my new sense of style, she interrupted me and she said, "Oh, this just must be a phase." And off she walked down that long hallway. A phase? I was devastated, coming from one of the best-dressed women in Manhattan. I mean, this really took me out. I was in a crisis. It was traumatizing. I later on was introduced to a spiritual practice, because you see, my parents had been doing Freudian therapy for about 40 years at this point, and I knew that I needed other sensibilities to help me navigate through this ongoing search for identity. So I was introduced to the pathwork. And the pathwork was about, it's about responsibility and it's about accountability. And at first I was a little scared. I could hear my mother in my head going, "Oh, you're not going to come home with a peach sheet wrapped around you slinging finger symbols, are you?" And of course she didn't say that. She would never say that. But that's what I heard in my head. But I decided to give it a go anyway. So I'm working the practice, and early on, as I'm starting to sort of get the flow of how to peel the onion and understand, and it was interesting because it was sort of like Freudian psychology meets spirituality, So it was like where I was coming from to where I was going. And one evening, we were on a workcation, we'll call it. Like, my dad was performing at the Golden Nugget in Reno, and he had invited the whole family, my sisters, their husband, my brother, his significant other, my significant other at the time. And it was like a Christmas to New Year's vacation time. And we were staying in this beautiful, massive cabin in the snowy woods of Lake Tahoe. And we were at dinner at the house. And my father had already left for the theater. And there was a fair amount of drinking going on. And my mother, now rum in hand, said something that so triggered me that I just got up and said, "I can't take it when you drink." And we got into it. I mean, we got into like a staring contest. And when I say we got into it, I mean we got into it. So we very quickly excused ourselves from the table and we went downstairs into this other like library den room in this cabin. And we had it out. And I said to her, "You know what? I got to start creating some boundaries. Like, I can't take it when you drink. I just can't. I don't like the criticism, the judgment. You're always talking to me about different members of the family. You know what? If we're out and you're drinking, I am going to remove myself from the premises." Well, she looked at me and she stood up and she said, "You can't tell me what I can and cannot say to you." And with ever courage I could muster, I took a deep breath to work this newfound practice. And I looked at her and I said, "Oh, but I can." This was huge. I mean, I thought, "Oh my God, what have I done? I've been colluding with this woman for her love since I'm a kid. We may never speak again." Well, after many years of arguments and extremely punishing behavior, we still do talk. But I realized when my daughter was born, I couldn't leave her alone with her grandmother. I just couldn't trust how my mother would be when she was inebriated. I didn't know she would never hurt her granddaughter. She loved her. She would never do anything on purpose. She wouldn't hurt a fly. But what I was most concerned on is about what she might say. You see, when my daughter started school, she started to dress herself. And let's just say she was like the living embodiment of Pippi Longstocking. Yeah. No, she would get bright colors with prints and polka dots and stripes and sometimes all at once. And I would look at her and I would hear my mother in my head and saying to me, like, "What are you wearing?" And of course, I wouldn't say anything because I wanted to nurture her creativity and her exploration of self. And I would think to myself, "Oh, well, this just must be a phase." And I knew that in those moments, I was becoming the mother I always wanted to be. And that working this practice, I was in fact going to have to start to parent myself. Well, it's been really cool now because my daughter, who has grown into becoming a brilliant, talented, beautiful young lady with an impeccable sense of style and grace, which I would say she gets probably about 85 to 90% from her grandmother, has been so helpful to me. You see, we have now moved my mom from her 93-year-old big life in New York City to her last chapter, but new adventure here in Los Angeles. Yeah. And I still have to work my practice. I find my patience gets tested, but I take a deep breath. But I sometimes ask her to do something and she's like a little confused or she takes more time. And I think about that song, "The Cat's in the Cradle," you know, where the kid no longer has the time for the parent. And I just do my best to work my practice. I think about Shakespeare's monologue from As You Like It, "All the world's a stage." I mean, he really got it on the nose. Because my mom really needs help with everything now. So, it is I who now takes that red Maybelline, black Maybelline eyebrow pencil, and I make that perfectly curved arch, and I take that burgundy lip liner, and I etch the border of her mouth and fill it in with that frosted pink. And it is I who now dresses her. And God has a sense of humor. She has grown very fond of tight, skinny jeans. Yeah. Where she used to want to hide her skinny legs. Now she wants to show them off. And she's grown really fond of this red Yves Saint Laurent scarf that she must wear all the time. And I'm like, hey, Mom, come on. Why don't we try a different scarf today? She's like, oh, no. I want my Yves Saint Laurent scarf. And I think to myself, well, this just must be a phase. But I realize it might be the last phase. Because as the monologue says, she will slip into the last scene of all that ends this strange history. Second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth. Sans eyes. Sans taste. Sans everything. So I work that practice. And I take a deep breath. And I reclaim my patience. And I reclaim my raptured fascination with the most beautiful woman in the world to me, my mom. Thank you.
Gina Belafonte is an award-winning producer, director, actress, educator, prison abolitionist, and freedom activist. She is co-founder of Sankofa.org. Gina has been using art as a tool for over 25 years to communicate messages of hope and civic engagement. As you probably figured out, Gina is the daughter of the great American singer, actor, and civil rights activist, Harry Belafonte, who died in 2023. Gina followed up to say that she and her mother, Julie Robinson, who eventually gave up drinking, enjoyed many years together, before she died at 95 in 2024, and she was still kicking it until the very end. You can share these stories or others from the Moth Archive and buy tickets to Moth storytelling events in your area through our website, themoth.org. There are Moth events year-round. Find a show near you and come out and tell us a story and let us know what the best advice your mom ever gave you was. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. Thank you to our storytellers for sharing with us and to you for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
This episode of the Moth Radio Hour was produced by me, Jay Allison, and Jody Powell, who also hosted and directed some stories in this episode. Co-producer is Vicki Merrick, associate producer Emily Couch, additional education program instruction by Nancy Ma and Arlene Chico Lugo. The rest of the Moth leadership team includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin-Jeness, Jennifer Hickson, Meg Bowles, Kate Tellers, Marina Kluche, Leanne Gully, Suzanne Rust, Brandon Grant, Sarah Jane Johnson, and Aldi Kaza. The Moth Education Program is made possible by generous support from unlikely collaborators. Additional program support is provided by the New York State Council on the Arts, the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, Alice Gottesman, the Cornelia T. Bailey Foundation, and Con Edison. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Andrew Bird, the CB3, Fearless Flyers, and Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans. We receive funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
This is Nick Carswell. Join me this Saturday at 5 p.m. on KPR for 105 Live, where we continue to showcase new music made right here in Kansas. Our live session this week comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with the Draper Family Band.
This is Brandon Draper from the Draper Family Band. Join us for our live studio session on 105 Live on Kansas Public Radio.
That's 5 o'clock this evening on KPR. From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Coming up next here on KPR, it's This American Life. Today on This American Life, stories of trying to bridge the political divide. What small thing gives you a shred of hope? That's just ahead here on KPR. Support for Kansas Public Radio comes from The Lead Center, hosting comedian Lewis Black in Goodbye Yeller Brick Road, the final tour, today at 7:30. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu. We've had a rainy morning. Looks like it might be a rainy afternoon, rainy night. Rain in our forecast for tomorrow, tomorrow night, and into Monday as well. Highs today in the lower 60s. It's raining and 57 degrees in Lawrence, 56 in Topeka. This is KPR.
Okay, this isn't news to anybody. Our country is profoundly, cataclysmically divided, disagreeing about so many basic things. The COVID vaccine, was the last election stolen? Was January 6th an insurrection, or as they called it on Tucker Carlson's show, a grandma selfie party? It's two different visions of reality that seem doomed to never reconcile. And maybe this is an inappropriate comparison, but somehow this comes to mind for me. You know that thing in your personal life where you get into a serious fight with somebody who you really care about, and they see it one way, and you see it another way, and you're not seeing eye to eye? The best outcome, the thing you hope for, is that by talking it through and really listening to each other and trying to sort it out, in the end, you'll either see it the same way, you'll have the same story, or, this is almost as good, you won't agree on what happened, but at least you'll get where the other person's coming from, and they'll get where you're coming from, and neither of you thinks the other's crazy or has ill intent. I just wish we could do that with our politics. I understand all the reasons why that's not happening. I understand how some people think, well, way beyond that, it's impossible, counterproductive, just a bad idea. But just to say, I wish. I think lots of us wish that. Without that, and, you know, divided so evenly, nobody can predict the outcome of a presidential election. Without that, how are we going to keep functioning as a country? But who's trying to bridge that gap between red America and blue America and bring us to a common story? I honestly can't name a half dozen people if I try. And so whenever I hear of anybody attempting to do anything like that and doing what seems like a decent job of it, I perk up. And I heard about somebody like that recently from somebody who used to work here at our show, Brian Reed. They did a story on this new podcast that he started with another former This American Life producer, Robin Semyon. Robin produces the show. Brian hosts it. And they did a story about somebody doing this, and Brian knows how I have kind of a bee in my bonnet about this particular thing, and so he sent me a copy, and I am very excited to present a version of their story for you right now, because it gave me a glimpse, like a very tentative first step kind of glimpse, and I know that's a mixed metaphor, but just whatever, a first step glimpse of the possibility that people in this country could listen to each other a little bit and look at the facts of something together and understand each other just maybe a little smudge better. We have some other stories in today's program. They're about couples managing their feelings during this heightened political moment, on the verge of all of us getting one president or another, one future or another. We're going to get to all that after the break. From WBEZ Chicago, this is American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for This American Life on KPER comes from Bob Schwartz Financial, helping Kansans with wealth management and investment planning across the state. Details at bobschwartzfinancial.com. The holidays will be here before you know it. So is KPR's Big Band Christmas. Join us Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall for an evening with the KC Jazz Orchestra. Tickets for Big Band Christmas are on sale now at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com. Made possible in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka. You can find out more about our Big Band Christmas at kansaspublicradio.org.
This American Life, Act One, a tiny thing that gives me hope. Okay, so like I said before the break, this is a story about somebody trying to bridge the gap in the way that Red America and Blue America see the world. And like I said, it comes from this new podcast that Brian Reed is hosting called Question Everything. It's a podcast about journalism, and the person trying to bridge the gap between the two Americas in this story is a journalist. In the story that they did on the podcast, they get to that guy in a little bit, but the story starts with a couple, Dick and Emily, who found themselves unhappily living on opposite sides of the red-blue divide. When they first met decades ago, he was a Republican. She was, she says, a bleeding heart liberal, but it wasn't a big deal. And then that changed. Here's Brian with one of the producers of Question Everything, Zach St. Louis.
So, Zach, you're the one who's gotten to know Dick and Emily, this couple that was fighting over the news, right?
Yeah, so their names are Richard and Emily Newton. He obviously goes by Dick. They're in their 70s. They just celebrated their 24th wedding anniversary. It's a second marriage for both of them. They fell in love singing hymns together in the choir at church. She's an alto. He's a bass.
That's sweet. Where do they live?
They live in Orange County, California.
Okay.
And over the last several years, they've found that they've been growing more and more miserable over something that seems so basic, which is what news they would each want to read in the morning.
We get up and get a cup of coffee, and we sit down, and we start going through our emails. And we sit next to each other when we're doing that. I'd say, Emily, I have an article here. Would you be interested in me sending it to you? And she would say, who's it from? And if I said Breitbart News or...
Breitbart? Is that what you mean?
Breitbart. That's it. Yeah, Breitbart. Or Epoch Times. She knew those were really right-leaning and wasn't really interested. I was the same way with her. She found something on Atlantic or New York Times or Washington Post.
Dick doesn't trust anything, no matter what it is, that comes from the New York Times, the Washington Post.
The Atlantic.
The Atlantic.
MSNBC.
CNN. That's
CNN is another.
So anything. It doesn't matter what they're saying. He just automatically dismisses.
Well, they developed their own reputation.
Okay.
I realized we are not reading from the same hymnal here.
So they told me that they started arguing a lot more when Trump came on the political scene. Dick supported Trump. Emily furiously did not. But then it was after Election Day in 2020 when they had one of their biggest disagreements.
From the beginning, I never believed that the election was fraudulently stolen. I have more faith in people and in our democracy. Dick was more open to doubt.
They were saying that there was a lot of things that were going on that shouldn't have been going on. There was packing drop boxes with ballots. One person would walk up to the ballot box and drop in all kinds of ballots into it.
So this particular theory Dick's talking about, it's from a movie, one of the many sources that he was turning to at the time. It's called 2,000 Mules. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. Yes, I've had people talk to me about it as I've been reporting, basically.
Yeah, so this movie, 2000 Mules, it looks like a documentary, but it's really a propaganda film. It's about a stolen election theory. It's not true, but for a while on the right, this movie seemed like it was everywhere. Everyone seemed to be talking about it. Trump actually did a screening of it at Mar-a-Lago. It was in something like 400 movie theaters. I mean, lots and lots of people believed it. It's made by Dinesh D'Souza. He's a right-wing political commentator.
All right, what's the gist?
The gist is that it's about this theory that a bunch of Democratic groups were paying people, who they call mules, to illegally collect ballots and stuff them into ballot boxes in key swing states.
Philadelphia alone, we've identified more than 1,100 mules.
So there are these talking head interviews, and they're intercut with this grainy surveillance footage that shows, like, this person, like, putting ballots into a box, and they're like, see, there's all the evidence you need.
But that's not real surveillance footage, or?
It is real surveillance footage, but it's showing people just dropping off ballots legally. And when Dick watched it, like a lot of people, he thought it seemed really plausible.
It just added to the other stories that I was hearing, things that were happening in Arizona and Georgia. I'm thinking, yeah, there's stuff going on here that shouldn't be going on.
So Dick is watching this movie. He's reading his sources. And there are so many sources that cite so many stories about election fraud, which is part of what made it so believable.
And also, he's watching the president, President Trump, say over and over again that the election was fraudulent and had been stolen from him.
Yes, exactly. And then Emily's consuming all of her own sources, and they say the exact opposite. And it all added to this feeling that it wasn't safe for them to talk about politics.
Did that feel different from other arguments or disagreements you'd had about non-political things over your marriage?
It did, because there was no give and take. We can argue about, you know, what we're going to spend our money on. We can argue about our kids. You know, we can argue about the neighborhood. But we usually come to some sort of resolution. This whole thing about Trump, there's no resolution.
How did that feel?
Frustrating. Because I know my husband. I know what a smart, sensitive, thoughtful person he is. He's very generous. I know all that about him. And to have him suddenly be aligned to this person who I found absolutely despicable was very troubling.
She wouldn't talk to me. She basically just, I don't want to talk about it. I would try, but it wasn't going to happen. And if it did, we'd end up yelling at each other. I got so angry with her one day that I just had to walk out of the house and walk down the street to cool off. And then I started thinking, wow, I'm letting politics get involved in our marriage because I was really angry at the time. And I just couldn't stand that. I never thought that politics was important enough to jeopardize what she and I had together.
Did you feel like that it could do that, that politics could jeopardize it?
Yes, I really did. I think, what did I get myself into here? Maybe I did something I shouldn't have done.
What's the mistake you're talking about?
Having someone that was so far left that I couldn't live with.
Oof.
Yeah, this was a pretty low point in their marriage. And they told me that they really wanted to find a way out of it.
We were both looking for some sort of, I don't want to say neutral, but impartial news source.
I was hungry for something that I could count on to peel the layers away and really show what's in the heart of it.
They started reading different online news sources that branded themselves as being unbiased, slant-free, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
And then they finally landed on something. It was a newsletter. Dick seemed to like it okay. So did Emily.
We both agreed. Oh, yes, let's read Tangle.
Tangle.
Yes, it's this daily newsletter, comes to your email. It's like a Substack type thing. It's run by a guy named Isaac Saul. He started it. He writes it. They have about 135,000 subscribers. It comes to your inbox every weekday, and each issue is all about one topic from the news. What they try to do is summarize two or three of the best
articles and arguments from right-leaning sources about that topic, and then they do the same thing with left-leaning sources. And the whole premise of the newsletter is that there are people out there, like Dick and Emily, that are reading completely separate sources, and why not put all of those in one place so you can actually read what those arguments are?
I think probably the first thing that astounded me was the transparency, that when they make a mistake, they correct it as soon as they realize it, and they put it right up front.
How is that different than corrections in a newspaper?
A little bit, it's the way that they do it. So corrections in a newspaper, you know, traditionally, they are at the end of the article. There'll be like a little footnote. Actually, we got this wrong. It's been changed above. We regret the error, you know, in like little print italics at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Tangle's approach to corrections, it's a bit different.
Can you show me?
Yes. This is from August 21st. And at the very, very top, the very first thing that you see is correction, period, in big letters.
Mm-hmm.
In our coverage of the Medicare drug pricing negotiations yesterday, we said that four of the Medicare Part D drugs for which the government had negotiated lower prices were overprescribed in the United States. That was false. We misread the abstract of a study and rushed our review process when we included it. A sincere thank you to the 10 or so readers who caught the error. And then in italics right below that, this is our 114th correction in Tangle's 263-week history and our first correction since August 13th. We track corrections and place them at the top of the newsletter in an effort to maximize transparency with readers.
So this is different than a newspaper, I see.
Yeah.
What else did Dick and Emily notice about Tangle?
Yeah, so they noticed that it wasn't so sensational. It was more measured or even-handed in their language. So, for instance, Tangle noticed that readers on the right would sometimes unsubscribe from the newsletter after reading a phrase like undocumented immigrant. But they also didn't think it was right to call someone illegal or an illegal alien. So they did this big internal review, and they settled on the term unauthorized migrant.
We really liked that approach, trying to filter out all the trigger words or the words that were very highly volatile emotionally, which helps both of us then consider the issue with less emotion about it. I'm not going to say with no emotion. We would still argue, but with less emotion about it. And then we loved Isaac's take.
What's Isaac's take?
So Isaac's take, Isaac refers to Isaac Saul. He's the founder and writer of the newsletter. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every issue, he spends a long time writing his opinion. And these can be long. And he says exactly how he feels about the issue after having researched it, and just describes his own feeling about it.
Wait, do you have an example of this?
Yeah, here, I'll send one to you. We can look at it.
All right, this was earlier this month. Hurricane Helene and the disaster relief efforts.
Yes. The first part is just the topic. Then they summarize what the right is saying. They summarize what the left is saying. But then at the end, you see my take. And so I'm obviously not going to read this whole thing. It is.
Yeah, this is long. Wow.
2,200 words, I looked.
It's like a whole essay. But what's his take on Hurricane Helene?
Yeah, so before we get to his take, I think you need to understand what he's responding to here. There have been a lot of attacks on the Biden administration from the right saying that they're doing nothing to help people who've been affected by this hurricane.
Like actually nothing.
Well, that they failed to rise to the occasion, basically. So Isaac, he really puts a stake in the ground and says there's a big problem with this narrative. It's all nonsense. It's all a lie. And then he writes, I hate writing pieces like this. It's not my job to defend the federal government from lies, and it's hard to write a piece like this without reading it like I'm openly shilling for Harris or Biden. I am not. I'm not here to do their PR or protect their reputations. However, I do care about our information ecosystem. I care about reliable, accurate information being shared widely. I also care about the North Carolinians in danger right now, not just because they're Americans and it's a state I love, but also because my mom, my aunt, my brother and his family, my sister-in-law, and my niece, they all live in North Carolina. So the horrors we're all witnessing on the news hit close to home. Here's the truth, though. Biden and Harris have actually pulled every lever federal executives can in a situation like this. None of the critics that I posted above can say exactly what they want them to do that they aren't already doing. And if you're planning on writing in to tell me that I am shilling for Harris or being a left-wing hack by calling out lies online, you better be prepared to tell me exactly what I've gotten wrong here. And then he goes on for several more paragraphs.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I can feel his resentment at having to defend the Democratic administration.
Yeah. He's like, I don't want to do this just to defend them. But in this case, they're doing everything they can. And that's what the facts show. And so I'm going to say that.
Right.
And this part of the newsletter was something that Dick and Emily really came to appreciate.
He was very clear about what his biases were. That made him extremely trustworthy. More often than not, when we get to the end and we read my take, we look at each other and say, yeah, that's how I feel.
They started realizing that they actually agreed with each other on a lot of things, and they were able to talk about it. And eventually, something pretty remarkable happened. So remember how Dick was totally convinced the election had been stolen? He watched 2,000 Mules. He read all of those conspiracies about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as Dick and Emily were starting to have this shared understanding of the news again, Tingle did the thing for Dick that no other source seemed to be able to do, that Emily wasn't able to do. And that was prove to him that the 2020 election had not been stolen.
The only thing that changed my mind completely was the fact that I started reading Tangle. And it's only because I trust Isaac and his team so much.
It's incredibly fulfilling, to be honest.
This is Isaac Saul.
He's the guy who writes Tangle.
Yes.
Just like, it's actually like so rewarding because the election fraud stuff in particular was one of the most difficult times of my life as a reporter. The month after that election, dark, stressful, really, really hard work. And hearing that somebody had that reaction, that their mind was actually changed, even one person, it's like, yeah, it makes me want to cry.
So am I getting this right? It seems like Isaac and this newsletter Tangle, they seem to have done something that I feel like so many journalists, myself included, have been banging our heads against the wall, trying to figure out what to do, which is, how do you get people to believe the evidence that the 2020 election was not stolen from Donald Trump? Something like a third of Americans believe it was. It's really threatening our ability to function. How do you present those facts and get people to believe them?
Yeah.
And you're saying Tangle did it.
In this case, Tangle did it. Yeah, for Dick, Tangle did it.
All right, so how did Tangle do this? How did Isaac, the guy who runs this, do this?
Yeah, so Isaac did a ton of work around this whole election denialism issue. It wasn't just one newsletter. Every time a new claim about how the election may have been stolen surfaced, he would spend all this time running it down, explaining in detail why it was false. He did that in the days and weeks immediately following the election. He continued doing it as new claims surfaced in the years since.
But a lot of news sources have done this, you know, looked at these different claims about how the election was stolen and showed why they aren't true and looked at the court cases where no evidence surfaced and all this stuff, right?
They did. But Isaac was doing a lot of research. Like, for example, in the weeks following the election, right after, he did this 400-tweet-long thread that was going in detail into each claim. He was really, really deep on this. But I don't think it was only the research that helped convince Dick. There's something else that Isaac did. And it was in his tone and how he approached this whole issue. Especially around the claims that seemed more persuasive, he didn't just write them off. He assessed them seriously, he presented them seriously, and that didn't make Dick feel stupid. Here's Isaac.
Some of the stuff was really convincing, and proving that they were wrong was not as simple as saying like, oh, this is just like conspiracy nonsense. Like the ballot stuffing thing, that was a plausible way to steal an election.
In 2022, he actually dedicated an entire newsletter, a deep dive into 2000 Mules, that movie we were talking about.
So when that movie came out and everybody just like laughed at Dinesh D'Souza, I was kind of like, I'm going to watch it and like take some of these allegations seriously and see what's up. It turned out they're all bullshit, but like you only know that if you actually do some of the work.
Can I actually just read you what he wrote at the top of that newsletter?
Yeah, please.
So the title of the newsletter is An Honest Look at 2000 Mules, The New Stolen Election Theory. And this is how he opens it. I consider myself to be both a skeptic and an open-minded person. I am deeply cynical about our government, believe intelligence agencies are covering up the truth about UFOs, and don't feel any particular loyalty to any major political parties. I generally distrust authority, government agencies, and politicians, but I do believe it's wise to consult expert opinions and advice. I love a good conspiracy, a good cover-up, and a great story. A stolen presidential election would be an all-timer in every regard. A story so gigantic, a conspiracy of corruption and power so unthinkable that the idea alone is tantalizing enough, I almost want to believe it. And then he goes on to dissect every point made in the film and show why it's inaccurate. But that's how he starts.
Interesting. Okay, so that's the presentation difference you're talking about?
Yeah, and I'll just say that that framing, it's really different from how other outlets covered this film. Like, for example, there's a New York Times headline about the movie. It was, quote, a big lie in a new package. There was a Washington Post headline that was, quote, 2,000 Mules offers the least convincing election fraud theory yet. And look, I mean, that's all true. It is a lie. But Isaac realized he's probably not going to convince someone who already believes the lie by leading with that. So instead, he levels with people, explains where he's coming from and all the research he did, and then explains what he found about the claims. And so this was what Dick was reading.
After reading his article, what I realized was, and he even admitted, there were some things that were happening that shouldn't have been happening in some of the polls. But it wouldn't have changed the dynamics of who won and who lost at all. That was actually the first time I really realized it for sure. And that really opened my eyes to how corrupt that was. That really sold me on the fact that the election wasn't stolen.
What I was thinking in my head was, like, I want to bring all these people in my life under one roof, and I want them to be able to read a news source that, like, the, you know, Trump MAGA bro will trust, and, like, the left-wing Bernie bro will trust.
What was the, like, origin story for Tangle, for Isaac? Like, he was a reporter before this?
Yeah, he was a reporter. He worked for Huffington Post, a couple of other places. And he told me that he's always been the type of person that's brought together people from different backgrounds in his personal life. Maybe they don't agree, and he's often mediating between those people. But really, the inspiration for Tangle came out of his own news consumption.
The idea for Tangle basically came from the Trump era of, like, Trump proposes a border wall, and I'm like, he's, like, proposing a 2,000-mile border wall. This sounds totally insane. I can't imagine the best argument for this, but I really want to understand, is this something that would actually work? And in order to grasp what was actually happening, my day would be like, I'm going to go read the New York Times editorial board. I'm going to read their immigration reporting about it. Then I'm going to go to Fox News and, you know, scroll through their opinion page and search for Trump's border wall. And then maybe I'll listen to, like, a Ben Shapiro podcast, and then I'll go listen to Pod Save America. And then, you know, I'll watch The Daily Show do a bit about it, or watch John Oliver. And then I'll spend, like, an hour on, you know, some Tucker Carlson special about it. And then I'll do, like, 10 hours of all this consuming the news, and I'll sit down and I'll be like, okay, I think I now have a really good understanding of everybody's perspective, positive and negative, about this policy proposal. Why can't I just find that one place? That should exist somewhere.
Do you know who's reading the newsletter?
I kind of do, based on a reader survey of Tangle subscribers. So a little bit over half of the subscribers are men, around 57%. It skews very white, just below 90% of readers. It's U.S.-based, but Isaac says it does reach something like 55 other countries. And about a third of the readers say that they're on the left, a third on the right, and the last third are either center or independent.
Wow, so pretty evenly politically split.
Yeah, pretty even split politically. And I did talk to some other readers of the newsletter who said that it had an impact on them, similar to Dick and Emily.
Like who?
I met this one guy at, like, a political event in New York, and he told me it's basically the only news that he reads. I talked to a new reader of Tangle, a journalist actually, and he said that there were some arguments from the right that he'd just written off. But reading Tangle actually helped him see that they had a point. And I even spoke to another guy who, like Dick, had his mind changed about the 2020 election.
I assumed that Donald Trump was telling me the truth, that they had firm evidence that it was definitely manipulation of the ballots.
This is a guy named Rick.
Wait, Rick and Dick?
Rick and Dick.
Okay.
Both Richard, if you want to be technical about it.
Got it. Go on.
It's a really similar story to Dick and Emily's. Rick was a big Trump supporter, voted for him twice. Rick's son is on the left politically. They were arguing about the news a lot. And the son started forwarding Rick the newsletter, including issues that were about the stolen election claims.
They weren't just laughing it off. I have a trust in their news gathering and presentation abilities head and shoulders above any other news gathering source. I have a trust level there that's unequaled.
And again, like Dick and Emily, Rick and his son have mended their relationship. They can talk to each other about the news again. And now he doesn't think the election was stolen. And that feeling of being lied to, it's actually convinced him not to vote for Trump this year.
Really?
Yeah, the only reason I wouldn't vote for him because he made me look foolish in front of my son.
You know, Zach, you mentioned the importance of striking the right tone when we're presenting evidence, especially evidence that's like contrary to what someone believes.
Mm.
And that does seem important, but also, you know, just hearing the story of Rick and his son alongside the story of Dick and Emily, his wife, like, I do just wonder, does a person have to be motivated to get along with someone they love, to repair a relationship, essentially, in order to change their mind?
Yeah, it's a good question. Wanting to see something from someone else's perspective, the perspective of someone you love, it seems like that doesn't hurt.
You know, it's interesting thinking about it. It's not exactly that Tangle moved both of them towards the center and they met in the middle, but it moved Dick more towards Emily, basically.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it would make for a better story if they each moved toward the center. I think that's sort of
met in the middle.
What we want from a story like this. Exactly, met in the middle. But it's really more like Dick believed something that wasn't true, and then he was the one that moved toward facts.
How does Emily say it changed her? Like, does she say it changed her?
So she told me that she didn't have as dramatic a change as Dick. It wasn't like she believed something that wasn't true and had her mind changed. But she says she does read the news differently now. For instance, she told me that hearing some of Kamala Harris's policy proposals and how before she would have taken some of them at face value as good ideas. Now she says she's thinking more critically about them.
Hmm. How are they doing these days?
Yeah, the last time I spoke to them, they really did seem to be in a better place. I think on the surface, it seemed like their problem was that they've been talking across this political divide. But their real problem was that they weren't agreeing on facts. They weren't agreeing on what was true. That's what made it so bitter.
It's a huge relief. Dick and I can now agree on more or disagree based on the same information, at least.
I don't feel like I'm walking on eggshells if I want to mention something to her. I mean, she's her own person. I'm not going to tell her who to vote for. And she wouldn't listen to me anyway.
Now we're on the same hymn book, more or less. Although he might be reading a different page than me at the time, but it's generally the same hymn book.
But I mean, agreeing on the same set of facts, being in the same book, that's only going to get you so far.
Who's Dick voting for?
You know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't like Trump as a person. The way he handles himself, the things he says, it bothers me a lot. But the one thing that I did like about him was his policies. And so I'm definitely leaning towards Trump still.
Okay, that's Dick's take.
That's my take.
That's the first time that he's verbalized to me that he's thinking about voting for Trump. My heart just stopped.
Emily and Dick Newton in Orange County, California.
So that's Brian Reed and Zach St. Louis of the podcast Question Everything, which is produced by KCRW and Placement Theory. The story was edited by Jonathan Goldstein and Robin Semyon. Coming up, other couples muddling their way through this election using slightly more extreme tactics. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. You can find us online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for This American Life on KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners to visit a dentist regularly. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. And from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series, Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org. Cloudy skies with a chance of rain, maybe even a thunderstorm this afternoon. Highs today in the lower 60s. It's 58 degrees in Topeka.
This American Life, I'm Ira Glass. Today's program, a small thing that gives me a tiny shred of hope. Okay, so it was Act One and the Tangle newsletter that inspired that name for today's episode. Now in the second half of the show, the thread from that story that we're going to pick up and keep pulling is what is happening with couples during this election, which is interesting because, as you've probably heard, there's a real gender gap between men and women this time out. Men prefer Trump by 8 percentage points. Women prefer Harris by 9. With that, we turn to Act Two of our show, Act Two, Till Death Do Us Partisan. Okay, so if you remember, Emily and Dick, who we heard in Act One, they talk openly between them about their political differences. One of our producers, Aviva de Kornfeld, spoke with a woman who is taking a different tactic with her husband.
It's been hard to find a time to talk with June. She's on a 3-week road trip with her husband, and they have almost no time apart. So we looked for little cracks in her schedule to sneak in a call. Do you have a sense of how much time we have right now?
Probably about a half an hour. He's in the shower.
Okay. Wow, half an hour. Long shower. Luxurious.
Well, he has a whole routine, you know, teeth and everything.
Yeah.
He's like a teenage girl in that way.
Okay. Do you mind if I record this call?
I don't mind, but I'm a little bit, you know, concerned about, you know, I don't want to get in trouble.
The trouble June's trying to avoid is an argument with her husband. They're both conservatives, but after voting Republican for her entire life, this election, June will be secretly voting for Kamala Harris. Her husband doesn't know about her plans.
So I really just, that's sort of why I'm a secret voter, is because I'll vote however I want to vote, but having the conversations about it is where things, you know, get just uncomfortable.
While we talk, June is pacing around the backyard of their rental house, where her husband can't hear her. It's not like she's scared of him. She just doesn't want to fight with him, which is why we're using a pseudonym. June's not her real name. The Harris campaign is counting on the idea that there are lots of Junes out there. They're marketing to these women, specifically, sending Republicans like Liz Cheney all over the country to talk to them. And there's a whole grassroots effort of people sticking post-it notes in public restrooms, reminding these women their vote is private. I wondered what it was like for people in this situation. Is it really possible to keep a secret like this from the person you share a house and a life with? How do you do that? What are the consequences? On our call, June made a point to say it wasn't always this way. She's been with her husband, who I'll call Rick, for 20 years now. They first met in an online group for single parents. June had 3 little kids from a previous pretty rough marriage. Rick had 2 kids, and their courtship started over the phone.
Yes. I mean, like being in middle school, like you'd spend all day with your best friend in middle school and then immediately come home and get on the phone with her. We would just talk for hours and hours and hours. It just felt like the easiest, most natural connection.
By the time June and Rick actually met in real life a few months later, they were basically already a couple. A year later, they got married, and Rick raised June's kids as his own, calls them his kids. June says Rick was totally apolitical when they met, had never voted, wasn't even registered, which did not sit right with June. She's always been very politically engaged, makes a real effort to vote in every election, not just the big ones. Since June was a lifelong Republican, Rick also registered as a Republican. And in 2016, they both voted for Donald Trump together. But June immediately regretted it. She never liked Trump, but it felt wrong to her not to vote, and she assumed he wouldn't win anyway. After the election, June started to lean away from her political party, but Rick reached towards it. He started watching Fox News every day.
And it's just stirring something up inside of him that makes him afraid or just like angsty or whatever. And like, it just comes bubbling out. Like, he's not a big talker to anybody else. I'm the main person that he talks to. So I think if he talked to a lot of people, maybe I wouldn't be getting so much of it down the barrel, but because I'm his, you know, I'm his main person, I think I get it all. Cause I think it makes him very anxious.
Does he have friends?
No.
Not even one?
I mean, he has, so one of the pastors at my church really likes him, but no, he doesn't really like people very much.
Rick used to ask June about her opinion on politics. She would read articles, and he would ask her to summarize them for him. That was a dynamic. She researched and came to an opinion, and he trusted her opinions. But these days,
the longer that Donald Trump has been on the picture, the sort of more like him my husband becomes, you know, just I'm not allowed to have my own opinions, and you know, I better not vote this way or that way, or, you know, I'm going to go with you and vote. And, you know, just really getting very hostile about it. And I guess Donald Trump just made it easier or more acceptable or more popular to act like that. And it's the only area where he's like that. But if we have a big confrontation about it, then it's, you know, then it becomes everything, you know. It's just...
Oh, I hear a little dog in the background.
No, just, yes, we have puppies with us, too.
June is having this disagreement with her husband during a moment when election coverage is nonstop. Ads are everywhere. Both campaigns are relentlessly calling and texting and emailing, all while she's stuck in a car with her husband. And this is all he wants to talk about. But June's got a couple strategies for dealing when politics comes up. Sometimes she tries something called gray rocking, which is basically just being as boring as possible in conversation, so Rick has nothing to seize on or react to. Other times, she tries for a classic maneuver, the dodge.
I dodge a lot. No, I'm pretty good at dodging because I'm very busy. Honey, I'm very busy making dinner. I'm very busy, you know, with the cleaning, or I have to do some work or whatever. So I'd say maybe once every 10 days to 2 weeks do I let my guard down.
And when her guard drops, a fight ensues. They have a big fight every 10 days to 2 weeks because it keeps bringing politics up. He wants to talk to her about all this stuff, and it unsettles him when they're not on the same page. He wants her to engage, and so her refusal itself becomes a kind of fuel.
It ends up being very pushy, you know, like, why aren't you talking to me? Why don't you answer me? Like, he'll say things, and I just take the bait, you know. He'll say, like, you're a liberal.
And what do you say?
I say, I've been a conservative longer than you've been a conservative. Like, what are you talking about? Uh-huh. Like, I am a conservative. Donald Trump stole my party.
Do you regret getting him politically engaged, given how things have turned out?
Totally.
Really?
Totally, yes.
I talked to a bunch of people like June, women who plan to vote for Kamala, but are going to all sorts of lengths to avoid telling their family and friends about it. They're all lifelong conservatives, but then, for a lot of them, January 6 crossed a red line they didn't even know they had until it happened. And now they can't bring themselves to vote for Trump again. I talked to one woman in Louisiana who told me her parents knew she wasn't going to vote for Trump. They assume she's going to write in another Republican, which she's happy to let them think. She said it's inconceivable to her parents that she could possibly vote for a Democrat. Another woman in Missouri told me that once Kamala entered the race, she tried to test the waters with her family, said she was thinking that maybe she would vote for Kamala. Her family's reaction was so strong, they said she was going to hell, that she was a communist, that she had to backtrack. And they haven't talked about it again since. I mentioned all this to June. I've talked to a bunch of people who are in different versions of your situation, and everyone tries to avoid talking about politics with their family because they obviously want to maintain close relationships with their family. And it's, they avoid talking about it in service of the relationship, but actually they just can't be as close with their family as they want to be if they can't really share this part of their life with them.
Right. I think, like, we sort of watch movies and TV shows where, like, one sort of explosive thing happens that ends up you know, destroying a relationship or whatever it is. But I think in actuality, those kinds of deteriorations happen little by little over time. And it's these small, small things that chip away at, you know, any family relationship or any kind of relationship. And so I think I probably just make a short-term, easy decision to avoid it. And it probably does have longer-term consequences.
I want to be clear. June and Rick still have nice parts of their marriage. They still go on their daily walks. They have those two little dogs that they both obsess over. Rick does this whole routine with the dogs during their nightly snack time, which delights June. But with the wall-to-wall election noise, politics is increasingly crowding out those other, more peaceful parts of their lives.
I have an older sister who's married to a like-minded man, and their relationship is just so different. There's just so much more back and forth between the two of them, and there's so much less just angst about, like, she can be who she wants to be, and he's just more secure in that, you know, she can voice her opinion, and it just doesn't ever seem like she's looking over her shoulder. But I definitely feel like I need to look over my shoulder, obviously, and sitting in the backyard. I just feel like I have to look over my back shoulder, not because something necessarily bad will happen to me, but just like it's just too exhausting to keep explaining myself, I guess. I just don't really want to keep doing that.
Who does your husband think you're voting for?
I think he's afraid I'm going to vote for Kamala. You know, I think he has a clue that I'm a never Trumper, but I wouldn't say like he knows for 100% sure.
Tell me if this is like way off base.
Sure.
Because I don't mean to overstep, but it sounds kind of lonely.
Oh,
being
my gosh,
in a
it's
marriage.
Terrible. Oh my gosh, it's terrible. Don't make me cry. Yes, he's not who I thought he was, or he's becoming somebody that, yes, it's like I'm not fully who I am with him, and it's sad.
Yeah. Do you have a plan for if it keeps going down this road, or is there, do you have any red lines, or you're just hoping, you know, once the election's over, then
yeah,
you can go back to talking about
yeah,
other stuff?
It sort of like steams up and then cools off. Yeah, I probably am not going to do anything. I mean, I'm on the phone. I'll be done in just 5 minutes. Okay. Yeah, it's not like a fun life to talk about Donald Trump. I just want to forget about him.
Was that your husband who came out?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, Giselle, it sounds like you should go.
I should probably wrap it up, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll let you go. I really appreciate you talking.
Sure. Thank you. It was good to talk with you. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye. A few days after our call, I got a text from June. She was home from her trip and had gone to vote early with her daughter. She sent me a selfie of the two of them, beaming, with their matching voting stickers. They both voted for Kamala. June said she felt relieved to have cast her vote, because now no one could take it away from her. And more than that, she actually feels excited about the prospect of a Harris presidency. She thinks she'll do a good job. After they voted, June and her daughter celebrated, hugged goodbye, and then June peeled her sticker off and went home.
Aviva de Kornfeld is one of the producers of our show. Okay, so the biggest gap between men and women in this election is with younger voters, people under 30. An NBC News poll found that 59% of young women in that group support Harris, compared to 42% of men. Which got us wondering, how is a person that age supposed to find love? Those numbers, if you are straight and under 30 and looking for somebody of the same party, they are not great. And that question brings us to Act 3 of our show. Act 3, let me be frank.
So when Aviva de Kornfeld was reaching out to couples looking for people to interview for the story that you just heard, one of the people she came across was a guy named Frank Filicomo. He's trying to navigate his way through the rocky shoals of this gender divide. So she talked to him, too, about what that's like.
Last year, Frank had a date that went exactly the way you hope a first date goes. The conversation felt easy. They made each other laugh. And at the end of the date, they said goodnight. No kiss. Frank doesn't kiss on first dates. And went home.
And then we were texted. She was texting me right after the date. Had such a great time. You know, when do we get to do this again? And, you know, we're exchanging ideas for what our next date's going to be. And then the morning of the second date, she messages me. And she said, you know, I did some thinking and I would not like to go out with you again. And
what do you think's happening when she says that?
Well, I didn't think. I knew what happened.
Oh, what happened?
What happened is that I have a very unique Italian last name. If you Google me, I come right up.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wrote, so you must have looked me up. And she said, yes. And she sent me a screenshot. And I went, ah, got it. You know.
The thing Frank's date had discovered about him, he's a Republican. Voted for Trump twice. The screenshot was of an article he'd written for a conservative magazine. Trying to date in deep blue New York City as a registered Republican, perhaps unsurprisingly, not so easy. He knows better than to lead with his politics. He intentionally leaves it off his dating profile. But even so, sometimes Frank can't even get past the texting phase and onto the actual date.
A lot of women have said, okay, you know, you seem great and I'd like to meet you and go on a date. But first, you know, who did you vote for? Or what are your politics?
Oh, really?
And then that's when I...
What do you say?
I say that I'm an independent thinker. And you know,
that's what, really coded as right wing.
Exactly. And
you might as well just say, yeah, I voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I have.
And then what do they say?
They say, well, I can't do it. Can't do it.
By Frank's estimate, 40 to 50 women have canceled their dates with him upon discovering his politics. Having been born and raised in Brooklyn, Frank has a sort of odd problem on his hands because he basically fits in unless he's talking.
Everyone I've ever met has told me that they think I'm some Bernie progressive. I strike people as being left wing.
Yeah. Well, you live in Brooklyn and you have little glasses, so.
I have little glasses. And holes in my ears.
He used to have gauges. He also has a bunch of tattoos. He's a real mix of things. He's got some punk in him, but he's also nerdy. Casually says words like verklempt and pugilistic. Though you can't see any of his edge today. Came straight from his job at a right-wing nonprofit. So he's in his full conservative drag. Suit, tie, token fun socks. Frank's been a conservative since he was little. He grew up in a right-leaning household and proudly wore a McCain Palin button on his backpack at school when he was 11. The main thing that makes Frank a conservative these days, he says, is that national sovereignty is extremely important to him, meaning he thinks we should close the border, build a wall if we need to, anything to discourage undocumented immigrants from coming here. Otherwise, basically, he's one of those fiscally conservative, socially liberal guys. But his dates mostly care about that conservative part. He remembers this one first date that really kind of stung because he was particularly excited about her. They were at a bar, bantering back and forth.
And then she said, so what do you do for work? And there's kind of no way around that. You know, I could say, I could be super ambiguous and say, oh, I work for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
But then that lends itself to, okay, well, which nonprofit?
Yeah, that could mean anything.
Right.
Frank told her he worked for a branch of the famously conservative outlet, The National Review, where he occasionally writes. His date thought he meant The Nation, which is kind of the opposite.
And I clarified, no, a little different.
How do you describe the difference?
I said, we're more on the right, which is my euphemistic way of saying we're conservative, because we are. And I said that, and immediately her whole demeanor changed.
They were only 20 minutes into the date. And decided to call it a night.
I actually planned on walking her out or walking her to the train station. And so I said, okay, let me get the bill. And I go up to the bar to get the bill. And then I came back and she was gone.
Frank thought maybe she'd gone to the bathroom. But his date had scooted to the bar and arrived with a helmet. Frank noticed the helmet was also gone.
I'm thinking, I don't think she took her helmet to the bathroom. But I said, let me give it a few minutes, you know. And I gave it a few minutes, and I said, she left. It does hurt. And when I say this to people, I don't mean to make it into a pity thing. You know, it's not like this is being conservative as some immutable characteristic, right? I don't want people to feel bad for me, but it does hurt. Because to me, it's like, who am I? So after 27 years, I'm 27. After 27 years of existence, if my identity boils down to being a conservative and a registered Republican, then that's a sad 27 years that I've lived. That's really sad.
Frank's a registered Republican, but to him, that's the least interesting thing about him. Here are some things that Frank would like people to know about him. He plays jazz guitar. He has a very old cat, 17 years old, who is still in remarkably good health. He's also obsessed with aquariums. He has 4 of them in his studio apartment. The stuff that Frank thinks should matter is the way you comport yourself in the world. Are you polite to wait staff? Do you hold the door for people? Do you check in on your friends when they're sick? Most of a relationship, he says, is not about politics. And so he wants the women he dates to see those other parts of him, not be blinded by his party affiliation. I asked Frank, why not just date conservative women? He insisted the conservative dating pool in New York City is simply too small. There's a filter on the dating app, Hinge, that you can pay for that does let you filter for political preference. He did try that once.
And I realized that it was meaningless, you know. I'm attracted to people for other reasons. In fact, I would put politics probably at the end.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Why is that crazy?
Because the thing that should be at the end is, like, my favorite color is green.
That's more important.
No, it's not.
It absolutely is more important.
Why?
I'm tempted to push it back on you and say, why is politics important? It's not important. I don't think so at all, actually.
Yeah, but do you think that politics is less important to you because some of the policies that you might be voting for directly impact you in a less personal way than they impact the women that you want to date?
Oh, maybe. I think that's part of it. And I have a lot of empathy for people who are impacted more directly. But I think that, you know, I look at my day-to-day life and, you know, I'll walk through a door and someone, or I'll hold the door for someone and they'll walk through and they won't say thank you. And I go, what was that? What was that about? You know, it's stuff like that, little interpersonal interactions that mean something to me, you know,
But to you, but not to the people that you're dating. I'm sure the women you're dating would be much, it's much more important to them to be able to get an abortion than have a door held
for
them.
Oh, sure. But I'm one out of 340 million people. I'm not effectuating policy or something.
I can see why his dates don't see it that way. I have some news to end this story with, which is that after dozens of dates, Frank is actually seeing someone. It's new, but it seems to be going well. She's a lefty, and she knows all about his views. Politics actually came up on their first date. It's been a few months now, and they've had a lot of conversations about politics. Frank told me his girlfriend's voting for Kamala Harris, and the idea that Frank might vote for Trump, that really, really bothers her. Recently, with the election coming up, they had one particularly hard conversation about it.
She said, you know, we care for each other, and we obviously enjoy being around each other, and we have for the past 4 or 5 months, however long it's been. And, you know, I don't think she said that she doesn't think it's a deal breaker for her, but it's something that concerns her, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't take that lightly. So it's made me do a lot of thinking.
What'd you say?
I said that I want you to know that I hear you. It was emotional. I think we were both a little verklempt.
His girlfriend kept saying, Trump's a rapist. You've got to vote for the whole person, not just the policies you like. These conversations with his girlfriend and other people have actually moved him. And so Frank is thinking of voting third party this election, which may have more meaning in his relationship than it does for our country, thanks to the Electoral College. Like most of us, Frank doesn't live in a swing state.
Aviva de Kornfeld. We first heard about Frank in a story in The Guardian. Well, our program was produced today by Bim Adewunmi. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Progressive Insurance, home of Snapshot, offering a personalized rate on car insurance based on safe driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California or from all agents. And from Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of your company in one simple and efficient business management platform. More information at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com. Thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia, always comparing himself to Mr. Potato Head.
I have little glasses and holes in my ears.
I'm Eric Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life. You've got a phone!
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute FM 90.3, K210CR in Atchison 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan at 99.5. Widespread showers throughout the KPR listening area this afternoon, tonight, tomorrow, into Monday. Otherwise, cloudy skies. It's 59 degrees in Lawrence, 62 in Kansas City. Coming up next, it's NPR News, followed by Trail Mix with Bob McWilliams. I'm Kay McIntyre. Have a great afternoon.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. In this final weekend before Election Day, both major presidential candidates are campaigning in the swing state of North Carolina today, seeking its 16 electoral votes. Republican Donald Trump is holding two rallies in the state, one tonight in Greensboro and this one this afternoon in Gastonia, where he predicted a heavy turnout.
I think they'll end up having many, many more people than they thought. This is going to be great, but we have to get out and vote. And we will, because I am thrilled to be back in this beautiful state. What a great state. You know, I have a little granddaughter named Carolina. You know that, right?
Trump said if he wins North Carolina, he'll win it all. Democrat Kamala Harris will also visit North Carolina today. She's holding a Get Out the Vote rally in Charlotte tonight. In these final days of campaigning, the vice president is offering some new details about what she would do on day one if elected president. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
Harris has said her top legislative priority is a package of bills to lower costs on everything from child care to housing. Here she is in response to a question I asked her today.
Day one is also me getting on the phone with members of the Republican Party, with leaders, with the private sector. A lot of my plan includes working with the private sector.
Yesterday at a local union hall in Wisconsin, Harris also promised to sign an executive order on her first day to eliminate college degree requirements for some federal jobs. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
The state of Texas says it will not allow federal election monitors at polling places next week. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton has more.
Texas Secretary of State Jane Nelson has informed the Justice Department that federal inspectors will not be allowed where ballots are counted or inside any polling places. She says Texas has its own procedures in place to ensure eligible voters participate in free and fair elections and will send state monitors to various locations instead. The Justice Department announced they were planning to send monitors to eight counties in Texas, along with counties in 26 other states, a practice the agency has regularly done during major elections to monitor for potential voting violations. The department is now required to ask permission or get a court order to be present at voting sites after the Supreme Court gutted portions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
The World Health Organization today resumed polio vaccinations of children in Gaza. Polio had not been seen in Gaza until a baby was partially paralyzed by the virus in August. The vaccination campaign began soon after that, but a second vaccination is needed. The second round was halted by Israeli air and ground assaults. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations meet their food needs from online ordering to simplified expense reporting with a nationwide network of restaurants all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. Here's the duo Paper Wings to open today's Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio.
I have seen it, I have seen it all. 100,000 years of rising and falling again. Nothing surprises me anymore. Talk to me, you can talk to me.
Kicking off today's Trail Mix, a song, It's Okay, is from their album this year, Listen to the World Spin. I'm Bob McWilliams. Welcome to Trail Mix. The duo The Vote Sisters play at Knuckleheads in Kansas City tonight. We'll hear some of their songs in about 7 minutes here on KPR. Right now on Trail Mix, it's a singer-songwriter from Edmonton, the province of Alberta in Canada. Her name is Jessica Heine. Let's hear from her latest album called Build Again. Jessica Heine on KPR.
I've been running in circles, getting nowhere new. Feeling a fool, I'm learning most people do. All the roads that could take no one else to choose the way and I would rather be dancing. One light, 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 light up my life. There is art in learning how to move. We create with every step we choose. Marble holding back a face, I only need to carve a way to show what I already know. Different way. I was trying to find common ground while the ground just fell away. I'm not sorry, I'm not sorry. I'm not mad that you are mad. And I don't want to start on it again. It's hard not burning bridges when the whole world's on. Looking for forgiveness, I believe there can be grace, but I bury my apologies and hide behind that faith. I've been spending time in silence, trying not to raise my voice. There's so much being said these days, I'd just be making noise. It's hard not burning bridges when the whole world's on fire. I'm tired of not knowing what to say. I'm tired of being inside my fingers, feels like it won't end. If my body can betray me, maybe anybody can. Maybe everyone has violence waiting in their veins, sleeps like a volcano and then rises up in pain. It's hard not burning bridges. It's hard not burning bridges. It's hard not burning bridges when the whole world's on fire.
That is Jessica Heine, her song Burning Bridges. Before that, the song Light Up My Life, an album from last year called Build Again, from the Canadian singer-songwriter Jessica Heine. We'll hear from the new album by Amanda Ann Platt and the Honeycutters in just a bit. The Vogt Sisters up next, and I had just said a few minutes ago the Vogt Sisters scheduled to be at Knuckleheads tonight in Kansas City, and they have been scheduled to be at Knuckleheads in Kansas City, and that's been on the schedule for weeks, but I just double-checked right now, and they are not on the schedule. I do not know what's up. I popped off an email. Don't know if I'll hear back in time to give you any other information, except they're not on the schedule. But what the heck? We've got some songs by them queued up, so we'll play them now from the album Homeward, the Vogt Sisters, and Emma's Song here on KPR.
I can see you clearly, twirling, tripping round. I don't want you to grow, but I know I can't stop you now. Emma, honey, can you hold my hand? We don't have long. Soon your world will grow, and I'll lay low my love forever in a song. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
I run a broken path between the pines, smoke and ash above and blood behind. Don't forget me, Father. It's not your fault. Don't bother feeling guilty for the life I chose to lead. Ooh, 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 ooh. Ooh, 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 ooh. Gypsy cry. You're much too young.